This week's Sound Off is brought to you by Audible.com. Do you guys like reading? Sometimes it can be a little cumbersome, right? I find it hard sometimes to read books, newspapers, whatever. Sometimes you just don't have the time. Well, I got a great solution for you. Why not have somebody read a book to you? That's how lazy we've become, but not really. It's actually pretty cool. Audible has a huge selection of books, over 100,000 wrestling titles, crime novels, science fiction novels, whatever floats your boat, all for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or other device. You can help support this podcast. Go to audibletrial.com/Solomonster. They have a free trial for 30 days you can sign up for right now. And as part of that trial, you get a free audio book. Whatever book you want that they have up in their store, check it out. And you can give it a try. I think you're going to like it. audibletrial.com/Solomonster for your free trial and audio book right now. The Solomonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
For the 326th time, welcome to the Solomonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, May 4th, 2014. May the 4th be with you. I am the Solomonster. You can listen to this podcast on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, iTunes. We're streaming now on player.fm. We have a free Android app in the Google Play Store, an unofficial Sound Off app created by one of our listeners for Windows 8 on your PC or tablet. So lots of different ways to listen, download the show, stream the show. So thank you for doing so here this week. Before we move on, I want to get some PayPal shout-outs out of the way, people who have donated to the podcast this week, for which I say thank you. You can always make a donation anytime you want to on thesolomonster.com. The PayPal donation box is on the right-hand side. Big thank you to Antoine Moore. He's a friend of the show. Fabian, Renegade Robaluzzo, the Digital Demon, Juan Cabrera. Juan is the one responsible for actually putting that Windows 8 app together, hence why I called him the Digital Demon. He does stuff like that that I can't. So big thanks to him. Glenn Super Cooper, Javon Main Event Mallet, and Moonraker Harry Moon Moon. I have no idea if that's your real name, Harry. If it is, you've got the coolest name of all time. But that's the name he wrote in with, and he made a donation. So you are hereby dubbed the Moonraker. And if you want a nickname, a wrestling nickname, they're not all winners, but if you want one, you can make a $10 or more donation to the show. But like I say every week, it's not, you know, a prerequisite. Donate whatever you can, whatever you want. It's entirely up to you. And just know that I appreciate your support. So big thank you to everybody who donated this week. Keep on doing that. I also want to make an announcement here right off the bat. Many of you know, if you follow along on Twitter and Facebook, I went through the whole situation a few weeks ago with the Layfield Report. I'm no longer writing for the Layfield Report, which is JBL's website. Had a lot of fun doing it. Did it for well over a year. But you know what they say, out with the old, in with the new. One door closes, another opens. And so now I am doing some writing for PWMania.com, which I'm very excited about. First column went up this week on how to save the Intercontinental title, or can the Intercontinental Championship even be saved? The way that that title has been booked over the last probably decade plus, really, in WWE. So if you want to check that out, if you missed it, it's up on PWMania.com as a featured column. I don't know if it's on the main page anymore, but you can search around and find it, or just look on my Twitter. You'll find a link there. And leave some comments. You know, you can leave comments under the article, which is always helpful, and we can interact there. Share it with other people. I hope to do many more of these in the weeks to come. And I do think it can be saved, by the way. This is not a column where I just riff on their mistreatment of this once glorious title and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I do that too, but I think the title can be saved, quote-unquote. I think it can be something meaningful again. And I talk about why, and like I said, I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts on that. So head over there and check that out. AJ Styles is the new IWGP Heavyweight Champion. He defeated Kazuchika Okada early yesterday morning in Japan to win the title at a New Japan show. Won it with the Styles Clash. The match is up on YouTube. Somebody uploaded it. I don't know if that was from an iPay-per-view or not. It must have been. The match, if it hasn't been taken down yet, it's floating around on YouTube. So I watched it last night. Pretty good match, too. Well over 20 minutes. Good stuff. That ends Okada's second run with the belt, lasting 391 days. And makes AJ Styles the first American since Brock Lesnar in 2005 to win the title. I think things worked out pretty well for old AJ since he left TNA. You know, the IWGP title means a hell of a lot more than the TNA title does. You don't need me to tell you that. That's pretty much self-explanatory. You know, he's over there now leading the Bullet Club faction. He's the champion. He's also got the gig going with Ring of Honor. And all the other independent shows, too. He's maintaining a very busy schedule, but he's doing good stuff over there. He'll now defend the title against Michael Elgin at the ROH New Japan show in New York City on May 17th, which I am very excited about. So the card has changed a little bit. I don't know what Okada's going to be doing. Maybe they'll put him in a tag match on the card. Hopefully he'll find his way on there. Now we shall see. What else do we have here before we get into the predictions? Yes, Network. Just really quickly, wanted to give some Network updates here. They are adding the old NWA / WCW Clash of the Champions shows, I should say, plural. They're adding them to the network. The first one is scheduled for this week. If you log on to the network schedule and you scroll, I guess, is it Monday? Monday or Tuesday is the first airing of Clash of the Champions, the very first one from 88 where Sting and Flair had that 45-minute draw. You can watch it now, even though it technically hasn't aired yet. It is available via VOD, so if you want to go up there and watch it. I don't know what the schedule is as far as how often they're adding new ones, if it's going to be every day, one or two per week. But they're starting to add those, and I believe when they're done airing all of the Clash shows, and those have been added, they're going to start with Saturday night's main event. So we're going to get a whole bunch of new content on the network over the next several weeks. News that broke this week on the investors' call on Thursday is that Tough Enough is, in fact, being revived, so they are bringing back Tough Enough. I don't know any of the details when. Supposedly, the format of the show is going to be a little bit different. Have no idea what that means. I don't know if that means they're going to bring Stone Cold back as a coach. If they're going to totally revamp this show, my guess would be no. They probably have some new idea for it. I just don't know what that is. But they are bringing Tough Enough back. Supposedly, there's two other reality shows that may possibly not even have anything to do directly with wrestling that they're adding to the network in the next year or so. I'm still hoping. I got my fingers crossed that Steve Blackman Bounty Hunter show gets picked up because that looked pretty cool. The other thing about the network also is Legends House. I've been talking about Legends House the last couple weeks. This was episode 3 this past week. This was probably the best episode yet. I still can't call it a show that you should drop everything and go watch, but this week it was a fun way to spend, you know, 55 minutes or whatever it was. You know, they got divided up, and one team of guys had to do a commercial for a car wash. The other team had to do a commercial for some pink flamingos that this guy sells as party ornaments. The point is, it was actually a pretty entertaining episode. I thought this was probably the strongest one yet. If you've got some time to kill, check it out. If not, you're not missing much. So that's really all I have to say about Legends House. I'm not going to go and do a full review every single week, but I will say this was the best one yet, I thought. And you know what? To go back to the Tough Enough thing for a second, I was just thinking earlier. You know, the news came out this week that Kenta is leaving Pro Wrestling Noah. Kenta is the biggest star in the Pro Wrestling Noah promotion over in Japan. Daniel Bryan has talked about Kenta as being one of, if not his most favorite opponent. They had tons of matches back when Bryan was in Ring of Honor. Some of them I saw, they were great. Kenta's a great wrestler. And there was a whole, not a controversy, but there was a whole thing a few months ago where he actually flew to the States after a loop of shows in Japan. He flew over here and he spent like a week down at the Performance Center in Orlando. And that had everybody thinking, oh, okay, this must be a tryout. He must be coming to WWE or they're considering him. And he pretty much shot that down after the fact. He flew back to Japan. He said, well, it was always a dream of mine to possibly be in WWE, and I just wanted to go and check out the Performance Center and train and lock up with those guys and just see what they're all about and basically just live a dream. It doesn't mean I'm going. I wasn't there for a tryout. He denied the whole thing. And I didn't really buy that much at the time. I figured, look, the guy is flying all the way from Japan after the shows that he performed at, flew over to the States, spent like a week here training down in Orlando. He wasn't training in Orlando just for the hell of it. They didn't bring him in and had people evaluating him, apparently, just for the hell of it. Clearly, he was being considered for a roster spot. It was a tryout. How serious it was, who knows? Apparently, it was serious enough because there's no confirmation, but if I had to bet money, I would put money down that Kenta is on his way to WWE. He is being very coy about that right now. That may just be because his contract doesn't end with Pro Wrestling Noah for another couple weeks. My guess would be mid-May. We'll find out more. And WWE maybe will make some sort of announcement. If they bring him over, that's a huge coup. I mean, he's not an old guy. He's 33, so he's not young either. But he's a great wrestler, and I don't know how his English is and that sort of stuff, because that's kind of important if you come over here to be able to communicate and do interviews and stuff like that. But if they pick him up, that's a big pickup for them. And supposedly there's still an outstanding offer to Prince Devitt. So there's a lot of really great talent that could very well be coming over to the Performance Center and NXT. Because I have no doubt that if these guys sign, they're going to NXT first. Doesn't matter how good you are. You will pass through NXT first, probably get a name change and a gimmick change and all that kind of stuff. And I don't think those guys need that, but that's just how they do things down there. But I was just thinking, you know, if Kenta comes over and Prince Devitt signs and comes over, would they put them on a new season of Tough Enough? Almost as like ringers on the show. And would that be the worst thing in the world? Because at first, when you think about that, the idea of putting a guy like a Kenta, who's got years of experience, and Prince Devitt, who's just phenomenal, and bringing them over and putting them on a show where, again, I don't know what the rebooted version might look like, but traditionally, Tough Enough was about bringing up guys, independent wrestlers, people who, you know, have only kind of toiled around in the minor leagues, so to speak, and to see if they can cut the mustard in WWE. And they do the eliminations, and you get voted off, and that sort of thing. And they had Matt Cross on the last season of Tough Enough. And Matt Cross is a good wrestler, too. You know, he's a good independent wrestler. He's been around for a while. He was like the second person, I think, eliminated on Tough Enough. And that, you know, pissed off a whole bunch of people. Austin Aries was considered. I think, actually, Austin Aries was supposed to be on the original cast for the new season of Tough Enough, but that was when Kevin Dunn and WWE got involved with the production company, and they saw the list of guys, and there were a few different indie guys on there, including Aries, and they're like, no, we don't want these guys. We don't want this to be a show full of just indie guys. We'll have one, which I guess is why they left Matt Cross on there, but then they just brought in all these other people, because they were looking for personalities. They don't give a shit if you're a great independent wrestler. That's not really what they're looking for. So this time, I just wonder, though, if they did sign these guys, and they have Tough Enough as this new vehicle on the network, and they want to try to get these guys over, I don't know. Is it really that horrible of an idea to put those guys, or one of them, let's say, on Tough Enough to try to help get them over? I mean, they'd have to win. I mean, yeah, you know, you have them on Tough Enough, and then you cut them on week two, and that's just a complete waste. But if the idea was, let's bring these guys in as ringers and put one or both of them on Tough Enough, and use that as a way to actually get them over. Like, that's our big idea, how we're going to get these guys introduced and kind of separate them. Instead of just having them in NXT and debuting like everybody else, just another guy. Maybe in their mind, that could be a way to help get these guys over. I don't know. I'm just, you know, I heard the Tough Enough news. I heard the Kenta news. He may come over. And I just thought, I wonder if they would do that. And I wonder if that wouldn't be the worst idea in the world. Because I don't know. I mean, their history, you know, their track record when it comes to, you know, the Japanese guys or the Asian talent, spotty. They have a spotty record when it comes to international talent, foreign. I'm not talking about UK guys. I'm talking more other parts of the world. I am not entirely enthusiastic about that when it comes to their history with those guys. So if they want to try something different, maybe that's not the worst idea in the world. Let's move on to Extreme Rules. The pay-per-view is tonight, as I record this, live from the Izod Center next door here in New Jersey. If you are going to the show, have fun. I know some friends who are going. I'm not. I'll be watching. This will be my first pay-per-view live on the network. Everybody was worried about streaming issues with WrestleMania last month and that sort of thing. I can't imagine if WrestleMania went off well that Extreme Rules wouldn't, so I don't foresee there being any problems tonight. I guess we'll see. Let's start from the bottom. And we'll work our way up to the top here. The pre-show match is El Torito and Hornswoggle in a WLC match. Now, they have not explained, unless I missed it, maybe on SmackDown they did. I didn't see SmackDown. I did see the Big E Titus thing on SmackDown, whatever that was. There was some black-on-black violence on that show is what there was. Those guys beat the crap out of each other. But I didn't see the rest of the show, so unless they explain the rules here, I'm just going to assume it's like every other TLC match. Oh, you know, what they're going to hang, where it's going to hang from, if they're going to have the Big Show stand in the ring maybe with something dangling from his hand, and they have to kind of reach up and grab it. I don't know, but they're doing a WLC match, and I have to say, everyone's all up in arms about this. Not everybody, but a lot of people are. Dare I say, this could actually turn out to be entertaining. El Torito, I think I've said this on the show before, because I was not that familiar with the guy's work. You know, there's a lot of Mexican minis out there. I can't say I know too many of them. But when he first got signed, I looked up some videos of his work down in Mexico on YouTube. The guy is unbelievable. I mean, as a performer, he's amazing. He's a lot of fun to watch, very athletic. He just flies all over the place. If anything, sticking him in a bull costume and not really doing anything with him is underutilizing this guy. If I were them, I would find a more frequent role for him on the show. And I know it's hard because they don't have a minis division. I would almost build one around this guy. He's that good. Why not build a minis division? Look, the minis division to some extent is always going to be a joke and they're going to play it for comedy. But they've done it before. You know, they kind of did it, I guess it was like 06 on SmackDown. They had Super Porky. That was total comedy. But if you go back even to the late 90s, for a while, what was the guy's name? It was Max Mini. They had Max Mini and, Mini Mankind, Mini Vader, and obviously that was played up as comedy also. But those guys could go, you know? It was something entertaining to put between, let's say, two big matches on a pay-per-view. Like now you have the Divas match as a buffer. Would anybody really care every now and then if they, you know, bumped the Divas match to a different part of the show and instead had a minis match with two guys that could really just go? I think it's kind of an insult at this point that still in 2014 with the talent they have in the Divas division and even down at NXT, they got a lot of really good women that in a lot of ways when it comes to these pay-per-views or special events, whatever the hell you want to call them now, the Divas are still looked at as the buffer. At WrestleMania, the Divas died a death because they were the buffer. They were the buffer between the streak ending and the main event. I mean, whatever was going to come after that Undertaker match was going to be dead anyway because I was in the building. And people were still in shock, and they were angry, and they couldn't believe it. You know, that whole Divas Battle Royal that they did at WrestleMania to me still is just a complete blur. I know AJ won. I don't really remember much else about it. I think it's an insult to the women to still put them in the buffer spot, that they still are the buffer between the matches that everybody else cares about. So I think it would help them to kind of move them out of that spot on a lot of these shows as another big match on a pay-per-view that people should care about. And you want to use the minis as the buffer? I got no problem with that. I'm just saying. If they wanted to do that, I would build the division around this guy. He's that good. Look him up. He's that good. So I think for that reason alone, if they don't, you know, if they give these guys some time and it's not just one giant comedy skit, if they actually let these guys go in there and have something resembling a match, this could actually turn out to be pretty entertaining. I'm not gonna cast it off and just bash it. If they do play it up for nothing more than comedy, and the comedy is bad, which 90% of WWE comedy is, well, wouldn't be the first time we've seen that on a WWE show, now would it? So whatever they're going to do here, I figure Torito's going over. He's my pick. Alexander Rusev against R-Truth and Xavier Woods in a handicap match. Rusev's going over here. There's no reason for him not to. He's demolishing everybody. My only criticism is that enough's enough with Rusev and Woods, and even Truth, but more so Xavier Woods. Xavier Woods has been demolished, I think, no less than 6 or 7 times now by this guy, including their matches on NXT, which they've had 2 or 3 matches there. They've had 2 or 3 matches now on Raw. Enough. Move this guy after this event. Move him on to somebody else. Start to get him some real competition. Let him mow them down too, but enough with these guys. Nobody cares. Rusev wins. Paige and Tamina for the Divas Championship. AJ took time off, so Tamina got the shot. This could turn out to be a good match, too. Tamina's actually pretty good if they give them some time. Paige, we know Paige can wrestle. I think it'll be a good match, and I think Paige goes over. I don't know if Paige can get her in her Scorpion Crosslock. Maybe she can. I guess we'll see. She's got the Paige Turner. It's good to have multiple moves. I'm a big advocate for having at least 3 or 4 big moves. That was one of the things I always liked about Sheamus. When Sheamus really first hit the scene and he had the bro kick was a featured move, but he also had I forgot what he called it, the Celtic Cross maybe, the Razor's Edge, which I guess they told him to stop doing because guys were bouncing their heads and risking concussion. But he had that move, he had the White Noise, he's got the bro kick, I think there was something else maybe. He could win with any number of moves. You know, now he's also got the cloverleaf, the Texas cloverleaf, Irish cloverleaf, whatever they want to call it. So I'm a big advocate for having multiple moves. Paige has two that she could win this with. So she goes over in this match. We have Rob Van Dam, Jack Swagger, and Cesaro in an elimination match. This is a little bit different than most three-way bouts in WWE, which is usually one fall to a finish. This time it's elimination style, which I like. And my pick here is Cesaro. He's the one getting the big push with Paul Heyman right now. RVD doesn't have to win. Swagger probably shouldn't win. So I'm going to go with Cesaro. Big E and Bad News Barrett for the Intercontinental Championship. I'm pulling for Bad News Barrett. I'm pulling for Bad News Barrett. I'm pulling for them to finally do something with this title. If putting the title on Barrett, because he's getting the push right now, means that we'll have Intercontinental title matches on TV more frequently, and that title will be more prominently featured, then I'm all for it. And I don't blame Big E for what's happened to that belt. I blame them. It's not his fault, but I'm going to go with Barrett. I just feel he's kind of getting all the attention right now. They went through the hassle of having that whole tournament. You know, I just don't see Big E just beating him and just moving on. Who does he move on to? You know, why not put the belt on Big E and then let, or Bad News, and have Big E chasing to try to get it back? So I'm going to go with Barrett. We have John Cena, Bray Wyatt, steel cage match. Interestingly enough, on the network, before NXT went on the air on Thursday, I saw an ad for the pay-per-view, and they are advertising this show as having three main events. It is a triple main event, according to WWE at Extreme Rules. So John Cena technically is main eventing this pay-per-view. I'm not saying his match will go on last. In fact, I know it won't. But he is facing Wyatt in a cage. If you can give me one good reason why John Cena should win this match, email me. I'd love to know. Because I don't think he should have won at WrestleMania. I think he should have probably lost at WrestleMania. He could have won this match, which actually would have made more sense. I would have been okay with that. Cena won at WrestleMania. So now they're doing the rematch on a show that far fewer people are going to see. And Wyatt is in a position where if he loses, that's two straight losses now to John Cena in big matches. I don't see what the point of that is at all. I don't get it. It doesn't make sense to me. So Bray Wyatt has to win this match. I still think there's something there if they want to get Wyatt up into the position as the number one contender for the title in the next few months. You've got the built-in story with him and Bryan having their history. He's got a clean win over Bryan on pay-per-view this year already. If he beats Cena, now he's beaten Cena and he's beaten Bryan. And you can make the case that, hey, this guy deserves a shot at the championship, and you could do a little program with him and Bryan, which I think would actually be pretty good. But Wyatt losing two straight times to Cena is just completely brain dead to me, and I can't imagine that that's what's going to happen here. So with or without interference, I love when they talk about cage matches. Well, we're doing it in a cage because we have to keep out Luke Harper and Eric Rowan. That's the whole point of a cage. We're going to keep you guys out. When in WWE has the cage ever kept out anybody who wanted to interfere? And that goes for Hell in a Cell, too. That goes for Hell in a Cell. That goes for Elimination Chamber. This gigantic 10-ton structure that has a top on it. It's got a roof. It's got chains all around it. Even the Elimination Chamber, people still find a way to get in there. The Wyatt family. At the pay-per-view this year. To start the whole feud with Cena in the first place. Lights went out. All of a sudden, the Wyatts magically appeared. They're in the chamber. Kane comes down. Because the door was open, granted. But still, Kane comes down. How does the match end? Kane interferes and costs Bryan the match. So don't give me that garbage that, oh, well, it's in a steel cage, and so therefore nobody can interfere. It's such an insult, you know, to the fans' intelligence when they say stupid shit like that. You want to keep people out of the cage? Set the cage on fire. How about that? Maybe that'll finally keep people out. But then again, they'll probably just cut a hole under the ring and they'll climb up like Kane did on Monday night. So please stop feeding us that bullshit that the cage keeps people out. It doesn't. If anything, the cage is like a fucking magnet. It just attracts people to come down to the ring. Anyway, Daniel Bryan and Kane for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship in Extreme Rules match. This is the second of three main events, I guess, or first, whatever order you want to put them in. I think this is going to be a really good match. I do. I don't ever need to see it again. I think after Bryan beats Kane on the show, which he will, Bryan's going to win. I think after he beats Kane here and keeps the title, actually, you know what? I shouldn't even say that. I don't know what kind of goofy finish they may come up with. The only one that makes sense to me is Bryan winning. He just won the title. He needs a big win. He hasn't been on television much because he was away on his honeymoon. Then his father died. You know, this great month turned to tragedy for the poor guy, so he hasn't been around much. Then he got dropped on his head three times. He's walking around with a neck brace. This month did not turn out too well for Daniel Bryan. He needs a big win. And I figure that's why they're feeding Kane to him, because you could feed somebody like Kane to him and it doesn't matter. Kane can serve any role you want him to on the show. And Kane's going to be just fine. He's Teflon. All you got to do is turn him babyface again and Kane will be beloved by everybody. So Kane is a good monster opponent, I guess, to throw in there since they had nobody better for Bryan this month. Kane winning makes no sense, but just to go back to what I mentioned before, I shouldn't say that Bryan for sure is going to win the match, because maybe they do a goofy finish or a no contest or something. My prediction is Bryan keeps the title. There's no way. There's 0% chance he's losing the championship in this match. I figure he's winning, too. But he is retaining the title. I think this could turn out to be a really good match. You've got the no DQ stip in there. Bryan has shown a mean streak over the last couple of weeks. Probably because, not just because of the angle, but I think because of what's happened to him personally. He's not happy-go-jolly right now, and so we haven't seen the Daniel Bryan come out that we're used to, where he's smirking on television, which actually kind of annoys me quite when he does that. He hasn't been smirking on television in the last couple of weeks, but I like that. I like the more serious portrayal of that character, and I imagine he's going to come out and be a little bulldog on the show and just beat the piss out of Kane. And this is going to be a brawl. It's going to be a fight. And, you know, you bring in weapons and all that kind of stuff. I think it's actually going to probably, I don't want to say steal the show. It could steal the show. But I think it's going to be a lot better than people are giving it credit for. So Bryan goes over here, and hopefully after this he'll move on to a more worthy contender for the title. And then we have the Shield against Evolution. Six-man tag team match. I don't know what's ending the show. You look at the positioning of these matches. It really all depends on, I guess, the outcome. If they want to go off the air with a happy ending, then Bryan winning is a happy ending. If they don't care, or if there's some angle they're building to here, then I figure Shield and Evolution goes on last. But it could go either way. To me, this is the main event of the pay-per-view. Bryan and Kane is not the main event. Cena and Wyatt is not the main event. In terms of how they've promoted these matches, if you want, you know, from the most promoted worthy main event match to the least, then it's the Shield Evolution match in number one and the Cena match in number two. The title match has been the least or worst promoted of the three main events, the least featured. And part of that was Bryan wasn't around, but that's pretty sad when you have a guy walking around with two titles who's in one of three main events and he's in the least featured main event on the show. But Shield and Evolution, I figure, will go on last, and I'm picking Evolution here. I really... you know, I don't know what they have in mind here. I, based on what happened on Raw Monday night, I was thinking along the lines of, don't trust Ric Flair. Ric Flair's going to put the screws to the Shield. He's actually still in cahoots with Evolution. Then I read that Flair isn't even scheduled to be on the pay-per-view, unless it's all just a swerve. He's not going to be there at Extreme Rules, unless that changes in the last few hours and they fly him out there. So if he's not going to be there, then there's no screw job with Flair. So what do they do? Is it just a straight match? You know, I don't know. I don't know exactly what they're going to do. I know Batista is leaving, I think, next week. I think he'll be on Raw and SmackDown, and then he's leaving. I don't know for how long. I don't know if it's for a month. I don't know if it's for 6 weeks. He's going to go off and promote his movie, his Guardians of the Galaxy film that's coming out in a few months. So that's one third of Evolution that's disappearing, unless they add some other new member to the faction. I always envision Evolution as being a short-term thing just to help get the Shield over. I never thought Evolution was back for good. Like 6 months from now, we're still going to have Evolution around. So this was always, to me, going to be a short-term thing to just go in there and have a great match with the Shield to put those guys over. But then I look at this whole situation here. In a perfect world, Evolution would win this match to build to a War Games match at the next pay-per-view that the Shield would win. But they're not doing War Games, okay? Unless they're going to do it with one ring instead of two. They're not doing two rings. Batista's leaving, so it's pretty safe to say that War Games is not in the plans here, even though it would make sense. when I look at this match and the people involved, Triple H lost at WrestleMania. Randy Orton lost at WrestleMania. Batista lost at WrestleMania. It's Evolution's first match back together in almost a decade. So to me, it smells like a heel win. The only real fly in the ointment here, thank you, John McClane, is Batista leaving. Because if Evolution wins, then they're one man down. I don't know what sense that really makes unless they win, and then maybe the plan is that the Shield is so pissed off and angry, they brutally attack Batista on TV this week and they put him out with an injury. You know what? That actually would not be the worst idea in the world, to give the Shield, you know, they're baby faces now, but give the Shield back some of that harder edge that they used to have by having them just beat the shit out of Batista, lay him out with a triple power bomb on the announce table, or just do something really heinous to the guy, and just that puts him out for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever. And you can still do the Shield against maybe Orton, Triple H, and somebody else, Kane, whoever, I don't know. That would not be a terrible idea. I just feel, even with Batista supposedly on his way out, I'm going with Evolution here. I just feel like they're walking out winners, and them walking out losers 2 months in a row on two straight shows, all three of those guys, it's possible, but I just don't see it. So they're my pick. And that's the pay-per-view. That's the rundown for Extreme Rules. Some good matches. I would watch Bryan and Kane. I really think that has the most potential as far as the singles matches. Maybe the Shield Evolution could steal the show. I mean, those are some great guys. They got involved in that match there. But Bryan and Kane, I think, are going to go out there and have a pretty good match too, despite the somewhat horrible storyline that they've been involved in. Monday Night Raw, speaking of horrible, this past week, the go-home show, live from St. Louis, Missouri. Shitty crowd for a mostly shitty show. This was not a particularly good Raw show. This was probably one of the worst Raw shows of the year, in my opinion. They're coming back to St. Louis for Survivor Series, so I hope those people wake up by then. Part of me doesn't want to blame the crowd because they didn't get a great show, but, you know, you pay for a ticket to go to a show. Would it kill you to show some life? You know, if anybody went to the show and they're listening to this and you feel differently, if the crowd was hot but it didn't come across that way on TV, let me know. Because I watched the whole show from start to finish and that crowd sucked. It was terrible. And when you have a bad crowd that's quiet and they're sitting on their hands, you know, it affects the whole enjoyment of the show. It just doesn't feel hot. It doesn't feel like there's a lot going on. So that's kind of the vibe that I had watching this show, which opened up with a John Cena promo. Asking the fans why. Why? Why did you boo me last week? Why have you been turning against me and cheering for Bray Wyatt? And why are you embracing his message? Cena said the cage on Sunday is not going to keep the Wyatts out. It's also going to keep Bray's message in. Well, not unless there's a top on the cage. It's not a Hell in a Cell match. The message has arms and legs and opposable thumbs. All it has to do is crawl out over the top. Apparently John Cena didn't think about that. I sound pretty stupid saying that, don't I? Well, that's exactly how John Cena sounded talking about this message crap. This dialogue was awful, but then came the best part. We had Bray Wyatt and the Wyatt family come out singing, he's got the whole world in his hands, which it got to the point where it was like, enough already. This went on a little too long. But I loved the last half of this segment. I thought it was great. I thought it was creative. I thought the visual of that was actually really powerful, having all these little kids. They brought these kids in from like a local high school and some other place. I forgot what it was called, but they brought these kids in, and they were all singing along. It was like a choir of kids, and they're all singing along with Bray, and they're walking to the ring. They surround the ring. The lights go out, and when the lights come back on, all the kids are wearing sheet masks. It was like a scene out of Children from the Corn. It was great. And Cena standing in the ring with his head in his hands. I mean, it was weird. Like, I'm looking at Cena, and he's trying to sell this. Like, oh my God, these kids have been corrupted. They've been turned against me, and Bray has just corrupted their soul. And he's got his head in his hands, and it looked like a panel from a comic book. You know, which is kind of what the story is here that they're telling. You know, Cena's the superhero, Bray Wyatt is the evil supervillain, he's corrupting little kids. You know, it's kind of like a comic book come to life. So I love the visual of the last half of this segment. I thought the dialogue and the message that Cena was trying to get across sucked. It was awful. But the visual was cool, so that's something. Usos and Rybacksel had a fun match. Usos are killing it lately. Those guys are awesome. Ryback and Axel, they were each part of the a Fatal 4-Way on SmackDown, which I have not seen yet. But they were part of a 4-Way for the U.S. title, which does in fact still exist, for those who may have forgotten about it. And they were teasing dissension between the two. So it appears that Ryback and Curtis Axel may not be a tag team for much longer. Maybe it was just dissension for one night and they kiss and make up and everything's okay. But that's what it sounds like to me, that they're teasing some dissension, possible breakup. You know, Cody and Goldust are also building to a split. So if you eliminate those two teams, let's say they both break up in the next couple of months, okay? So Rybacksel goes away, the Rhodes Brothers aren't a team anymore. The Real Americans split recently, Cesaro and Swagger. That leaves us with the Usos, the Wyatts, the Shield, maybe, I guess you can consider them a team, the Matadors, 3MB. Maybe they bring up the Ascension soon from NXT. There's been some rumblings about that. All right, I guess when you put it like that, there's still a decent number of teams that they have. It's not like they have two teams left. They have a few. That's not too bad. They still need, I think, one or two really strong teams to give the Usos some more competition. They still have to do some work building up some fresh teams in that division. But I guess they have more than I thought. Sheamus beat Titus O'Neil in a match where Titus attacked him before the bell, showed some real fire here, as he did with Big E on SmackDown before he got his ass kicked. Got some real aggression here from Titus. He took the entire match, pretty much. It wasn't a long match, but he took the whole thing, just completely kicking Sheamus' ass. And then Sheamus just out of nowhere nails a bro kick, got the pin. And the kick looked great, I will say that. Kicked him right in the face. They've really got to find something for Sheamus at this point. Just turn the guy heel. I've said this so many times already, since he came back, even before he came back. I did a whole column about it on Yahoo months ago. You know, they should have done it when they first brought him back. It's time. You know, I look at the lay of the land after this pay-per-view as far as challengers for Daniel Bryan, and I see slim pickings. I don't want to see another match with Kane when this one is over. I don't need to see Bryan versus Orton part 5,789. I don't need to see Bryan versus Triple H again either. I mean, they had a great match at WrestleMania, but been there, done that. There's Bray Wyatt, assuming he wins the cage match. But a heel Sheamus would fit right in there. You know, they had awesome matches together in the past. Go back to 2012 when they were feuding and Sheamus was the world heavyweight champion. And I remember, I think there was a 2 out of 3 falls match at Extreme Rules 2 years ago. That was awesome. Were it not for Brock Lesnar and John Cena on that same show, that would have been the match of the night. So they've worked well together in the past because, look, after that, who else is there? John Cena? I mean, I can't see them doing Bryan versus Cena again for a while. And I would save that for a big pay-per-view like a SummerSlam, maybe. Someone did suggest Bryan and Brie. Forgot who it was, but they said Bryan and Brie in a mixed tag match against Triple H and Stephanie. Maybe with Bryan's titles on the line. I could see that. I really... First of all, I'm not a fan of putting the title on the line in a tag match like that. I hate that. They've done that before. I just hate that. I really don't want the Brie stuff to be long-term. It's fine for now. You know, they've brought her into the storyline here. After this, they just need to stop that and keep them apart on TV. I just don't think anything positive could come from Bryan coming out and involving his wife in storylines every week. Even just in terms of wrestling storyline history, that's probably not a good thing for him. So they're doing it now. I want to see them move away from that. But they really have to start thinking about who this guy's going to go up against because, I mean, what the fuck are you going to do? You're going to keep putting him in there with the same guys over and over again? I know Sheamus is kind of the same way. It's not like him and Bryan have never wrestled before, but it's been a while, and I think if you turn the guy heel, it's been a while since we've seen a heel Sheamus. It would be, in some ways, very fresh. And I would not mind seeing that feud. But they got to do something with the guy. They had the same problem before he got hurt. Sheamus was just a guy with no direction. He was kind of feuding with the Rhodes Scholars. Like, he had no real meaningful feud going on. Then he got hurt. And I figured, okay, they'll use the 6 months away to freshen him up, and he'll come back, and they'll have something for him. what the hell has the guy done since he came back? Nothing. He's done nothing. So this would be the time, I think, to do the turn. We had the Dolph Ziggler, Hugh Jackman, Damian Sandow segment, Magneto. The magnetic pull of this segment sucked the life right out of this crowd. Jackman's fine. Jackman's a likable guy. He always seems very happy to be there. Supposedly, he takes the time backstage to go around and shake everybody's hand and introduce himself and chat with them, and that's really cool. But this segment was, it was an abortion. You don't need me to recap this crap, do you? I don't think I need to recap what happened here. We all pretty much know what happened. We know the lot in life that's been dealt here in this company to poor Damian Sandow. He walked out there. It was kind of weird. Somebody had a side-by-side photo they put up on the Facebook group where it was a picture of The Undertaker in his current garb when he would come out on Raw in that hood. And Sandow as Magneto on Raw. It looked like Sandow was wearing the same kind of hood that Undertaker wears, only it was in the ridiculous Magneto, purple, pink colors, whatever the hell it is. He looked like a bizarro version of The Undertaker. And bizarro, not only in terms of the getup, but bizarro in terms of his push. The complete and polar opposite of The Undertaker. Paul Heyman came out to introduce Cesaro, told a knock-knock joke. Said, knock, knock. Who's there? Mike? Mike who? Mike, client. Brock Lesnar broke the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania. Give that man a cookie. That was fucking great. This led to Cesaro versus Jack Swagger. Cesaro won with a German suplex. Yes. Didn't look all that good. But I tell you what, it did not look anywhere as bad as the one that The Rock lost to. The Rock had a match with Chris Benoit on Raw back in 2000. This is one of those obscure references that I still remember. So they had a match, and in the match, Benoit gave The Rock, this might have been their first match, a German suplex. And Earl Hebner was the referee. Earl, for whatever reason, maybe there was interference from the other radical members or whatever, but he was like way down the aisle. So he's not even anywhere close to the ring. And maybe these guys just didn't realize it. It looked like Earl was probably out of position. He is nowhere to be found. Now, Benoit has just German suplexed The Rock. He's got the bridge going. Rock's shoulders are down. He's just kind of laying there. No referee. And they had to wait and wait and wait and wait until finally Hebner comes into the ring and he counts three. So they didn't even call an audible here because of how horrible this looked and say, you know what, fuck it, kick out. Kick out a 2.5 and we'll do the spot over again. He just laid there and took the three count. And, you know, every time I see a German suplex finish for the rest of my life, I will immediately compare it to that match. And it will never be as bad as that spot was in that match. Renee Young tried to interview John Cena backstage, but he blew her off. So you think, great, right? Finally, Cena has, he's been left speechless. He's got no words for what happened earlier in the show. Makes sense, given how disturbed he was. Fast forward to later in the show, and she tried again. And this time, not only did John Cena have something to say, he had jokes. He said something about a donkey that... did I say donkey? Why did I say that? Donkey. Some people say donkey, some people say donkey, some people say aunt, some people say aunt. Some people say tomato, some people say tomato, some people say potato, some people say potato. What the fuck is wrong with me? I don't know. You know what? I blame Cena for this. Damn it, because he's on TV talking about a donkey. I don't even remember what the hell he was talking about. All I remember was the fucking steam that was coming out of my ears, so I couldn't even hear the rest of what he said. I was so pissed off. I mean, Christ, even on a night where we're supposed to believe that Bray Wyatt has gotten into Cena's head, finally, he's lost the kids, you know, what's going to happen on Sunday at the pay-per-view, they still have him out there cracking jokes. He said something at the end about breaking his foot in Bray's ass that got a nice pop. But that did not make this segment any less terrible. This sucked. We had Stephanie McMahon coming out to apologize to Daniel Bryan and Brie for what happened the week before. So Bryan did show up on television this week in a neck brace. We talked about this last week. I thought it would be very hokey for him to show up after such a hard injury angle. It was a major injury angle they did with him and Kane to get him off TV so he could tend to his family business. I figured, you know what, there's no real need for him to be on the show this week. You can have him call in over the phone, Skype him in, wearing a neck brace at home, and he cuts a real passionate promo on Kane. But nope, they had to have him there. It was so important for him to be physically in the building, so he's out there in a neck brace. And not only did he come out to make an appearance, he got physical on the show. You'll notice Daniel Bryan, who got dropped on his head 3 times and had his wife threatened, did not come out and tell jokes in this segment. I know, right? What's wrong with this guy? John Cena needs to smarten him up. So Stephanie did apologize for what happened. Bryan didn't buy it. And to convince him of her sincerity, she granted Brie a Divas Championship match with Paige right now. And I tell you what, they did a thing here that I actually did like. I'm not a fan of this whole angle, but they did this thing where 2 different times at different points during the show, they have a camera shot of Stephanie's office backstage, and they slowly pan over, and you see the glass case with Kane's mask and wig in it. And it's just sitting there. And they don't talk about it. They don't reference it. They just kind of fade out. Well, after Stephanie announced all this, and we're getting ready for Paige versus Brie, we get one more segment backstage, only this time when they pan to the glass case, the mask is missing. It's not in the case anymore. And I actually thought that was really cool. I like how they did that. Just one of those small things. But we had Paige and we had Brie. No contest. Match really wasn't much of anything. See, the weird thing is that could actually be a pretty big match, I think. But this was, it's just a complete waste here. It was just to set up the angle that followed. So it went to a no contest when Kane's music hit. He came up from underneath the ring. He tried to drag Brie down to hell with Zack Ryder. But Bryan stopped him. He got thrown around a little bit on his bad neck. And then he retrieved a wrench from underneath the ring. And he waffled Kane right in the head with this wrench. Poetic justice, seeing as how Kane once used a wrench on Vader. So let's see how many of you remember that. Kane was out for a while. Then he did the Michael Myers sit-up. Kane gave Bryan a choke slam. Once again, he tried to drag Brie down to TNA. I mean to hell. Brie managed to wriggle herself away from Kane anyway, because somehow he can choke slam men with one arm, but he can't hold on to a 65-pound woman. Seriously, I think each of Nikki's breasts weigh more than Brie does. It can't be healthy. So this whole angle was just hokey. When they start getting into the whole drag down to hell and, you know, I mean, does this World Heavyweight Championship feud really need this right now? You've got this horrible thing that happened to Bryan, and they have not acknowledged what happened to Bryan's dad. And I'm okay with that, because in the past, when they start bringing shit like that into storyline, it gets very uneasy. You know, they did the whole thing with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler. I know Lawler was fine with it, but still. You know, Lawler's mother died. He was very close to her. They had Michael Cole on TV talking trash about how his mom just died and you're a disappointment to her and all this other garbage. You don't need to be doing stuff like that. But, you know, if for them to acknowledge that this horrible thing happened to Daniel Bryan and our best wishes are with him and his family, so just that fans on TV are aware of it and then you don't make any mention of it again would be okay. You know, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But in a way, I almost think it would help the angle. Because Kane did this awful, heinous thing to Bryan, right? Even threatened his wife. And we know that Bryan's dad died. So if he would have showed up on TV this week to do a segment via satellite or something, like, everybody knows the horrible things now in real life that have happened to this guy. Now he's on TV. He's not cracking jokes. He's not smirking. He's not smiling. He's just staring right into the camera, and he cuts a passionate promo on Kane, and he vows no matter what, clearance or no clearance, to be at the pay-per-view on Sunday, and I'm going to kick your ass. Like, to me, that's a basic, effective promo to put this match over at the pay-per-view on Sunday. Like, sometimes less is more, old school, right? Keep it simple. That's all they had to do. You mean to tell me that this bullshit here was better than doing a basic segment like that? Was that really necessary to start getting into the hokey, dragging her down to hell nonsense? That's why this whole angle has just been, I don't know. I can't get into it. I think the match will be fine, but this angle has just been a fail to me. Bad news, Barrett beat Rob Van Dam with the Bullhammer Elbow to win the Intercontinental Title Tournament and a shot at Big E at the Extreme Rules pay-per-view. Swagger and Cesaro both ran down. They ended up fighting with each other. That distracted RVD in the process, which led to the loss. Van Dam gave Cesaro a 5-star frog splash when the match was over, and this was all done to set up the 3-way at the event tonight. Finally, main event was Roman Reigns and Randy Orton. First time we were told that these men were going one-on-one. Before the match, with both groups out there, Ric Flair made an appearance. It was his big return to Raw. He said it was great to be back in the ring with men who were dominant. And then in a swerve, he indicated that he was actually referring to The Shield, not Evolution. So a big endorsement for them, although Flair did wink at Triple H as he left the ring. So never trust Ric Flair. Sting has learned that lesson the hard way many times over the years. And again, Flair, last I read, was not even going to be at the pay-per-view. So maybe they're not going to do the turn after all, but I still wouldn't trust the guy. Match ended up a no contest. Everyone brawled. Evolution got the best of them, but The Shield got a second wind and stood tall to end the show. And that's another reason, why I think Evolution may be going over here. You know, The Shield looks strong at the end of Raw, and they look strong again at the end of SmackDown. Now, that doesn't always mean anything. I kind of laugh at people when they base their whole prediction on pay-per-view matches. Well, so-and-so was left standing at the end of Raw, so obviously that means the other guy's going to win. That logic doesn't really apply anymore, but when it happens on back-to-back shows, you know, it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder if these guys were left looking strong on Raw and SmackDown, whether or not they'll actually be left standing tall at the pay-per-view. I don't think they will, but would not be surprised if they won. I'm just not predicting a Shield win. I've got my money on Evolution. So that was Raw. Not a very good show. It had its moments, but not many of them. Adam Rose, on the other hand, he makes his Raw debut this Monday night. Adam Rose and the Party Patrol, or whatever he's calling them, and all of his Rose buds. I hope he brings the bunny with him. The bunny, to me, is the best part of the whole act. On Wednesday, WWE released a handful of NXT names, so we'll run through them really quick here, including some names that might surprise you. Among them, Mason Ryan, who was actually on the most recent episode of NXT, losing a match to Tyson Kidd. Mason Ryan has been with the company for many years. They found him, he's Welsh, I think. I don't know actually exactly where he found him, I don't really remember, but they brought him into the fold because of his look. He looked like a Batista clone. And that's why even to this very day they would chant at him, you know, better than Batista, now that people hate Batista and all that sort of stuff. When he came in, he got shot onto TV pretty quick as a member of the New Nexus, back when CM Punk was leading the faction, and he looked gigantic. He looked inhuman. He had one of those bodies that probably would fit in perfectly back in like the 80s, early 90s WWE. You know, a guy like him might even be considered small compared to some of those guys back then. But now, you know, with the wellness policy and everything else, and I'm not accusing him of anything, I'm just saying whatever he's doing or whatever he was doing, he was huge. He was well beyond his proportions. Because Mason Ryan, if you look at the Mason Ryan of today, is actually a lot smaller than he was then. But by no means is Mason Ryan a small guy. You know, I saw him, he wrestled the match against Sylvester Lefort when I went to the Access session at WrestleMania this year, and I stuck around, I watched some matches. They came out for a match. Mason Ryan's a big dude. He's a big guy, but you compare him now to the way he was then, he went through some sort of transformation that we can only speculate on what that was. And he couldn't do much. You know, it's hard when you're that big and thick and muscled up to really do much. So he got picked on a lot and made fun of and mocked for being green, having two left feet, not knowing how to work. And, you know, maybe it was a little unfair because they brought him in and didn't really give him that much training before they put him on television. And I think they realized that after a while because what happened? They took him off television and they sent him down to developmental to work and get better. The problem is he got a little bit better, but he's been there now for years. Not months, years. And after 2, 3, 4 years, whatever it's been, you know, he's improved, but he hasn't improved the way that you would think after 3, 4 years a guy would improve. He was nothing special. He would come out, he would have matches, his posing, everything was just so wooden about the guy. You know, he could do some basic power moves and stuff like that, but he really didn't do much beyond that. It was all about the body. And guess what? The body didn't look as good as it used to. So when you take that away, what do you really have? I mean, do we ever really see a lot of charisma out of the guy? We never had a chance. So to me, it's not a surprising cut. I don't think we're missing much at all. But I guess, surprising in that they invested a lot of time in the guy, and I think they finally came to the realization that we've gone about as far as we can with this dude. He's not going to get much better. If he hasn't already, it's just not going to happen, so let's just cut our losses and move on. So he's out. Oliver Gray, who just returned to NXT after almost a year off from an ACL tear, he was actually just on the show this week, in fact. He got cut. He was at one time co-holder of the tag belts down at NXT with Adrian Neville. Danny Burch, who also made an appearance on this week's show. Clearly, they were trying to get as much mileage out of these guys as they could before they cut bait with them. And Shaul Guerrero, the daughter of Eddie and Vicky Guerrero, had left developmental a while back. I don't remember what the reason was, why she left, if there was a problem, or she went back to school. I don't remember exactly what the reason was. She was getting pushed down there, but then she left. She came back. I think she may have been doing an act at the live events, managing Cal Bishop, who's one of the other NXT guys that we see on TV sometimes doing a job. I think his gimmick is or was, he was doing some biker dude gimmick and she was put with him. But clearly it didn't have time to go anywhere because they cut her. I don't know why they cut her, but they cut her. So those were the victims of Black Wednesday this week down at NXT. JTG survives the axe yet again. Another round of cuts in WWE and somehow the guy's still employed. The dude's got more lives than my cat. So my hat's off to him. I don't know how he does it, but keep on doing it. It's not a bad gig. Hey, if you can get that work, you collect a paycheck, sit at home and do nothing. I don't even know. Is he even on the road? I haven't been to a house show in a while. I don't even think. I read the results for these house shows. I never see his name. So he's not even doing the live events. He's not on TV. He's not at NXT. Is the guy alive? Can we check on him? Can we do like a welfare check on the guy? Is he still around? Has anybody even bothered to check and see? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the deal is with him. You know, I mean, maybe there's guys that they're just going to hang on to them until their contract runs out instead of firing them. But, I mean, at least with the other guys, even a Zack Ryder, they get some TV time. I don't know what's up with JTG. I don't know what the deal is there. First show of a four-show taping, you could tell, because the crowd was amped up for this week's show, which always helps. It was highlighted by a no disqualification NXT championship match that left me wondering what the hell the point of a no DQ stipulation was here. We'll get to that. Triple H opened the show without his voice, so this was taped, I guess, back when he had his Jake the Snake voice going. Came out to announce NXT TakeOver, the next live special, 2 hours at 8 Eastern on Thursday, May 29th. We had Bo Dallas come out with his new inspirational music in Titantron. I guess this is what we can expect when he makes it to Raw. They completely revamped his whole entrance. He came out for a match with Tyson Kidd. So Bo Dallas' losing streak on this show continues. Tyson Kidd caught him coming off the top rope with his buff blockbuster move, whatever he calls it. There was a lot of fans swaying and singing during this match. He's got the whole world in his hands, which hopefully does not turn into a thing during Bo Dallas matches, just because he's brothers with Bray Wyatt. God, what a family tree that is. Irwin R. Scheister, Bray Wyatt, and Bo Dallas. Holy shit. I would never in a million years think to put those three together, but they're a family. Devin Taylor interviewed Camacho backstage, who cut a promo on Adam Rose. I was too distracted by him looking at something or someone off camera to pay any attention to what he was actually saying. I went off on cage matches earlier in the podcast. Now I'm gonna go off and direct my venom towards this camera angle bullshit here. You know, this is how they're teaching these guys now down in Florida. It's infuriating. You know, they have a guy who's cutting a promo backstage. It's one of those stand-up promos where you have a Devin Taylor, a Renee Young, a Josh Matthews, whoever, standing there with a mic in their hand, and the guy is talking into the microphone, and instead of looking at the camera or even looking at the person, I can understand if, let's say, the guy is looking at Renee. I mean, who wouldn't want to look at Renee Young, okay? Look at the announcer. They're the one standing in front of you with the mic in your face. Or look in the camera. Look at me. I'm watching you. Look at me, right? That would make sense. That's how it was always done. Not now. I mean, what is he looking at? Cue cards? Lana's legs? I mean, if so, I don't blame them, but God, I mean, just let these guys look into the camera, please. They look so stupid when they do that. All right. I feel better now that I got that out of my system. Let's move on here. The Women's Championship Tournament. Yes, we have another tournament now that the Intercontinental one has come to a close. Paige was stripped of her women's title last week by JBL, so now we have a tournament to crown a new NXT Women's Champion. They put the bracket up, and the opening round matches have Bayley against Sasha Banks, which we had this week, Natalya against Layla, which we also had this week, Emma and Charlotte, which is coming up next week, and Alexa Bliss against Alicia Fox. Alexa Bliss has not yet made her debut on TV, so I don't know how they're going to handle that. I saw Alexa Bliss in action for the first time at Access over WrestleMania when they were having all the NXT matches. She had a match with Sasha Banks that was really not that good. A little rough around the edges, so I don't know how this one's going to turn out. Alicia Fox is really good, so maybe she can kind of carry things there. But that's your bracket. We had pre-match promos here from Bayley and Sasha Banks before their match. And by the way, they're talking directly into the camera. How about that? What a novel concept. Need to do that more often. Bayley claimed that winning the NXT Women's title was more important to her than 10 hugs from John Cena or 5 high fives from Big E. I think that would kill the poor girl. Then she came out for the match, and ladies and gentlemen, I do believe we have a new candidate for best NXT entrance ever. Two giant inflatable arm-flailing tube men now pop up when Bayley comes out. I fucking love inflatable tube men. I don't even know why. If I see them on the side of the road at like a gas station or a grand opening or something, I can't look away. I want one. I want one for my apartment. Better yet, an inflatable tube woman. How about that? I'll have to ask Noah Mark if his inflatable woman's arms flail around. I think he rolled over and popped it once. Poor bastard. Sasha Banks beat Bayley, so she got her win back after losing to her the last time. William Regal teased when the match was over the possibility of Sasha and Charlotte colliding in the finals. Heel versus heel in the finals, I think, is unlikely. Adam Rose beat the recently released Danny Burch. Afterwards, Camacho ran down. He attacked one of Rose's party buddies, who looked an awful lot like Curry Man to me. The reactions from the dude in the buddy costume were priceless. Whoever's in that suit deserves a fucking raise. This was great. Natalya beat Layla in what was shockingly a terrible match to advance to the semifinals of the Women's Championship Tournament, so she will meet Sasha Banks. You would expect with these two in there, they would have at least a good match, but this was sloppy as hell. You know, a couple times it looked like they forgot what they were supposed to do, and it just kind of fell apart until Natalya slapped on the sharpshooter for the submission, so pretty disappointing. Mojo Rawley squashed the also recently released Oliver Gray, who did not look particularly good here. He was out of position for some of Mojo's moves. Maybe that's why he got the boot. Who knows? He was also using heel mannerisms, which was weird, given that when he came back 2 weeks ago, he appeared to be a babyface. All of a sudden, he was seemingly a heel again. Aiden English came out. He cut a promo on Mojo, tacked him. Mojo fought him off, knocked him out of the ring, so I guess that is the next program for the two of them. And in the main event, Adrian Neville beat Brodus Clay with the Red Arrow to retain his NXT title. About as lame a no-DQ match as you'll ever see. The only thing that happened in terms of that stipulation was Brodus grabbed the belt late in the match. He tried to use it as a weapon to hit Neville with it. It backfired. That was it. The match was short, too, 4 or 5 minutes maybe, which hopefully means this whole Brodus Clay-Adrian Neville feud has reached its conclusion, and we can move on now. I get why they did it. They wanted to put a main roster monster guy in there to give some credibility to Neville. He got it. Now let's move on. To Brodus's credit, though, I will say, you know, they had pre-match promos from them. Brodus, he's not a bad promo. You know, when you let the guy go and just tell him, listen, you're pissed off in this segment. Here's what you talk about. Go. He's pretty good. You know, he's pretty good. It's just hard. You know, we talk about Eric Young and TNA. I'm going to get to that actually in a second here in the review, but people ragging on TNA for Eric Young being the World Heavyweight Champion, and you know, and I see their point, because Eric Young was a joke for 10 years in that company, and all of a sudden we're supposed to take him seriously as a world champ. It doesn't work. 6 months from now, if he still has the belt and he's had a whole bunch of great matches and bloody brawls and that kind of thing under his belt, maybe people will feel differently. But it's hard, man. It's hard when you got a guy who's treated like a joke for so long, and he's treated as a prelim, undercard, mid-card geek for so long, to all of a sudden take them seriously as a champion, as a contender in the main event. Brodus Clay is in a similar situation, because for so long he was somebody call my mama, and he would come out and dance, and he was the Funkasaurus, and now he shed that gimmick finally, which ran its course, but it's hard to take a guy like that seriously in a position like this. So, like I said, they did it. It's over. It's time to move on to bigger and better things with Neville. We'll see who they match him up with at the TakeOver special. I don't want to get into the spoilers here. We know who his opponent is, but some people may not want to know until it airs. Hopefully that's a sign, though, that they are moving him in a different direction. Hopefully it's a sign that at some point in the near future we'll get Tyler Breeze in there. I know I keep harping on that guy, but he's actually really good, and I would not mind at all seeing an Adrian Neville-Tyler Breeze feud for the title at some point. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service, and it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. TNA. We had Sacrifice, the pay-per-view last weekend that I think six people saw. And one of our listeners wrote in to say, because there was a match on that show with Sonata and Tigre Uno. It was actually the culmination of their best of three series for the X Division Championship, which I thought had the potential to be the best match on the show. And since I didn't see all the matches on the show, I saw some stuff after the fact. I can't judge how it ranks as compared to everything else. But he wrote in to say, it was hilarious that the very same day you talk about the respectful culture of wrestling in Japan, which is what I mentioned on the Sound Off last week, he says, you have people on this show chanting, let's go Goku, and laughing at Sonata in TNA. Now, I don't even know what Goku, I had to look it up. I don't know what a Goku is, or who that is. I looked it up, and I got a whole bunch of Dragon Ball references. So I assume it has something to do with the Dragon Ball cartoon, anime, or whatever the hell it is. So, you know, hey, look, it doesn't surprise me. You're going to have people like that. I mean, that's just how things are. You know, that's how the fans here can be. Sometimes you have crowds that are more respectful than others, but that's just something you would never, ever see in Japan. You wouldn't have people in the crowd mocking and riffing on, you know, the Americans when they come over. You just wouldn't see it. It doesn't happen. It's just the difference in culture, but anyway, still distressing to hear that. Unfortunately, that kind of shit happens, but it is what it is. We had James Storm and Gunner. I wanted to talk about this. I did see their match. I heard good things about it. I watched it. They had basically a no-holds-barred brawl. They had a really, really good, hardcore, like, knock-down, drag-out brawl that would have fit in great, I think, if you go back to the old days of ECW or the Attitude Era, or if this were on a pay-per-view that was watched by more than six people, or in front of a crowd that was more respectful. By all accounts, this was not TNA's best audience. The crowd didn't care about a lot of stuff, or they mocked other stuff, or they were just overall very quiet and disinterested. And I watched the match, and you could tell, like, it really hurt the match a lot. It was actually kind of pathetic to watch these guys out there beating the hell out of each other. I mean, they were beating the hell out of their bodies. James Storm at one point took a superplex off the top rope in the ring onto a piece of the guardrail that they had dragged into the ring. So it's the metal guardrail, and it was laid out. I forgot if it was laid out between two chairs. I think it was actually two chairs, and it was kind of elevated across the two chairs. And he just got superplexed right on top of it. Gunner was bleeding like a stuck pig. At one point, James Storm broke a beer bottle over his head. I have to imagine it was gimmicked, but whatever it was gimmicked, maybe it wasn't gimmicked. Maybe in TNA they actually break a real beer bottle over your head, which if they did, they're a bunch of dummies, because I don't know why the hell you would do that. Hopefully it was some kind of gimmick deal, but even so, the pieces of it, whether it was real glass or something else, were cutting these guys up. James Storm's body was all cut up from it. He got slammed down, and oh, I mean, it was like, they're killing each other for nothing. Nobody cares. Like, nobody in the building cared. Nobody was watching this show. But these guys, to their credit, they went out there and they wrestled like they were wrestling in the main event of WrestleMania. Like, those are the guys that TNA better value and better do more with, and thank their lucky fucking stars that they still have guys on that roster who care as much as those two guys did on this pay-per-view. But I just got this vibe. It's like so sad, you know, watching this. And I'm getting into the match, but the crowd is so quiet, you could hear a pin drop. It's like, what the hell's wrong with you people? You know, these guys, if nothing else, just show these guys some respect. Because at one point, not only were they quiet, but they were chanting, oh, what the hell were they chanting? They were chanting something disrespectful that had nothing to do with the match. Like, they would have been better off just not saying anything at all and just staying quiet if they were going to do that. So that was one of the saddest moments in the whole show to me. A show that had the greatest referee bump in the history of referee bumps. And technically, it wasn't even a bump because the guy never got touched. It was during the Bully Ray, and you all know about this, I'm sure, but for those of you who don't, the unfortunate few of you who don't, you must go online immediately. Go on Facebook, go on Twitter, Google it, do whatever you have to do. There is an animated GIF floating around of this unbelievable ref bump where Bully Ray is about to powerbomb Bobby Roode through a table in the ring. And clearly the spot here was supposed to be that when Bully picked up Roode, Roode's foot would hit the referee, Brian Stifler, in the face, and he would take a bump and lay on the ground and pretend that he was knocked out. Okay, that was the idea. Unfortunately, when Bully picked up Roode, he was a little too far away from the referee, and so Bobby Roode's boot never came in contact, not even close, with the referee. But in that instant, in that panicked moment, the referee had a decision to make. Do I sell this anyway and look like a fool, or do I not sell it and maybe we could try to do it over again? And I guess the referee decided, you know what? I'm not one of the guys here in this match. I'm just the referee. I don't want to fuck up their match. I'm going to sell it anyway. Or I'm going to sell it because I don't want to get in trouble for not selling it. And he proceeded to have what appeared to be a brain aneurysm. Maybe a stroke. I'm not quite sure. I hope he's okay. I think he was on Impact this week, so he should be fine. This did not look like a bump as much as it looked like one of those things I just mentioned. He kind of, how do I even describe it? You got to watch it for yourself. But he kind of started shaking back and forth, and then he just fell down. It's the greatest thing I've ever seen. I have to actually give credit to TNA. It was the best thing on a wrestling show I saw all week. And that goes for Raw, Legends House, NXT, SmackDown, Impact, anything. The best thing all week was this ref bump last Sunday at Sacrifice. That will go down in the annals of time. When the day comes that Vince McMahon can buy the tape library of TNA, I say go for it. Like, don't pass on it. Go for it. And if you use no other footage from this tape library, 12 years of TNA, you must somehow use that footage, maybe on a future countdown episode on the network. They can rattle off the top 10 ref bumps or something, or the top 10 most, biggest bloopers in wrestling history. This one would be way up there. I don't know if it would be number one, but this one would definitely be on my top 10 list. So find it. You can find the GIF. The great thing about it is whoever hosted it, when you find the image, when you find the animation, you can actually zoom in. You can zoom in and out. You can slow it down. You can speed it up. This is the greatest thing ever. Awesome. Not so awesome was the finish of the match, which saw Dixie Carter. I don't know if she came out or if she was out there the whole time and nobody recognized. But she was out there dressed up like a man. She was almost, in a way, dressed up like the photographer whose camera exploded in Hulk Hogan's face at the King of the Ring back in 93. She had like a fake beard on. And she shoved Bully Ray off the top rope. What happened was Bully Ray had the match won, but the ref was bumped. So the ref didn't see that Bobby Roode went through a table. So the match continued. Because apparently there's nobody in the back in TNA who could come out and say, hey, this fucking match is over. Let's ring the bell. Nobody came out to help the referee. The guy had a brain aneurysm. Nobody checked on him. The guy could be, you know, bleeding on the brain. Nobody would know. He's laying there. So good to know that kind of work environment exists in TNA. So the match continued. Bully goes up to the top. He's got Bobby Roode set up on a table on the outside. He's going to jump off the top and crash through the table. Now, why he would do this, because I don't believe another referee had come out. Maybe I'm misremembering here. But he's going to jump off the top rope. Before he could do it, Dixie Carter, delusional Dixie, shoves him off the top. Now how she knows that Bobby Roode is going to move out of the way in time, I don't know. She's putting an awful lot of faith in this guy. Bobby Roode did move, and Bully crashed through the table, and he lost the match. I think the bell just rang. Maybe she called for the bell. I don't know. This whole thing was a clusterfuck, and she takes off her disguise, and she's ripping it off her face. You know, Eric Bischoff dressed as the minister for that wedding angle with Billy and Chuck on SmackDown. This was not. That was one of the best angles in WWE history. I think even Bischoff has said that that was the best angle he was ever part of his entire career. And that includes his WCW stuff, the NWO stuff. That says a lot. That was actually a really well-done disguise angle they did on SmackDown that year. This was, you know, I saw her just ripping the stuff off her face, and for whatever reason, it reminded me of that. But I just don't understand what the point was. Like, why did she have to be in disguise? Why couldn't she just come out and shove Bully off? Why did she have to be dressed up like a dude? I think they just kind of did it for the sake of doing it, but it just made no sense in doing it, and that's kind of the story of things in TNA. So anyway, that was Sacrifice. Yeah, Eric Young won the main event against Magnus. They had a good match. It was a straight match, no interference or anything. So they're continuing to push him. They're trying to get him over as a world champion. Which brings us to Impact this week. Opening segment was backstage, Eric Young, MVP. They have a meeting. MVP brings in Ken Anderson, he brings in Gunner, Bobby Roode walks in. They're trying to determine who gets the next title shot against Eric Young. And Bobby Roode says, well, I beat Bully Ray, so I should be the number one contender. Gunner, of course, beat James Storm at the pay-per-view. Anderson did whatever he did to Sam Shaw, sent him to the Nut House. Cuckoo! So he's gone for now. So all these guys are backstage now, and MVP says, you know what, let's play some cards. MVP says, the person who draws the highest card gets a bye. And the people who draw the two lowest cards are going to have a match tonight on Impact. The winner of that match will meet the person who drew the highest card. And the winner of that match will meet Eric Young in the main event for the title tonight. All on the same show. Another Russo hallmark. Lots of title defenses on TV. I mean, you know, Eric Young has already beaten Magnus twice. So he's done. He beat Abyss. He beat Bobby Roode on this show. In the main event, they blew that off. You know, their roster is thin enough as it is. At this rate, he's not going to have anyone left to defend the title against. So Anderson and Gunner both drew fours. Bobby Roode revealed an ace. Anytime I hear the word ace mentioned on this show, it just gives me horrible flashbacks. So it's Anderson versus Gunner with the winner meeting Bobby Roode later on. I did not mind the card game. I see people riffing on TNA on our group page. Oh, you know, that's how they determine a world title contender, you play a game of cards. You know, it's no more or less stupid than the way WWE picks contenders for its titles. Okay, let's be honest here. We're going to be fair about this. WWE has done a lot of stupid, even Money in the Bank, if you really think about it. I mean, you talk about a way to devalue your titles. You know, you're going to win a briefcase, and then at any time, you just kind of cash in and win the championship. I mean, we're used to it now. It's become kind of an institution. You know, even TNA copied them, like they've done so many other ideas, you know, with their Feast or Fired stuff with the briefcases. So, but I mean, we could really break it down here and talk about whether it's a Raw roulette gimmick or I mean, look at Kane. Explain to me again what Kane has done to warrant a world championship match on pay-per-view after being dressed as a suit as the director of operations now for how many months? And how many big matches has he had? How many big matches has he won? Exactly. So if you're going to criticize them for that, it goes both ways. I didn't mind it. It was kind of clever for one night, for one segment. As long as he doesn't make that his recurring gimmick, it's not a big deal. Magnus came out to explain, or complain, I should say. What else is new? He's always out there to complain. He's complaining about being left out of the title picture. Abyss came out from the crowd. They brawled. He gave Magnus a chokeslam. He went to grab a chair. but the fans, for some reason, chanted for Dixie Carter's mom. They chanted Janice. Thought he was going to pull her out from under the ring, kicking and screaming. But instead, he pulled out his board with the nails in it, and Magnus wisely bailed. Bully Ray came to the ring with a table that had delusional Dixie's name spray-painted across it. He vowed to put her through it sometime tonight. He said she would be going through a table. And that was it. Short and to the point. Gunner beat Mr. Anderson after James Storm's interference seemingly backfired. He ended up nailing Anderson, and then Gunner, not seeing this, I guess, used his Hangar 18 move to get the pin. The announcers, you know, the announcers played it up like Storm made a mistake because he helped Gunner win. But it was pretty clear, if you watch Storm's facial expressions here, that it was no mistake. So it's too bad the announcers' TV monitors short-circuited, and they weren't able to see this. If they did see this and they still said that, then they're fucking idiotic. Backstage, Magnus was packing his bag. He was ready to leave when he was confronted by a newcomer named Bram, who is the former Kenneth Cameron from The Ascension in NXT. He was arrested. What happened with that is he was arrested twice when he was down in developmental. He was arrested once for DUI. I think he was arrested for beating somebody up, like battery. I think it was actually battery against a cop. Maybe he was drunk, whatever the case may be. So they shit-canned him, and they plugged Rick Victor into the Ascension tag team. So anyway, Cameron also happens to be married to Charlotte of NXT, which makes him Ric Flair's son-in-law, which is an interesting relationship connection there. So they hugged like they were friends from back in England. Bram said, you know, I'm here to talk some sense into you. He called Magnus an embarrassment to his family, an embarrassment to the UK. He reminded him of the old days when they used to carouse and drink and chase women. He said Gunner had gone soft, or Magnus, I should say, has gone soft. And he shoved him up against the locker. He says, I'm here for your own good. And then he walked off. So I guess that's a new program there. A new direction for Magnus, who is out of the title picture. The four-month experiment with Magnus as champion is over. Failure. Magnus is not bad. You know, he's actually one of the better promos, I think, in the entire company. Like, he's very well-spoken and articulate. He kind of looks like a star and all that kind of stuff. But the way they booked him, you know, Chris Sabin is probably the worst example of the booking of a world champion in TNA, kind of like Rey Mysterio as champion in WWE many years ago. But Magnus is way up there on the list as far as worst booked world champions or worst world champions of all time. It was not a good 4 months. If you really look at how they, you know, how they portrayed this guy, the whole storyline was that he was a paper champion. He never deserved the belt. So I call that a failure. I don't know what you call it. I call that a failure. Cut back to the ring. EC3 is already in there cutting a promo on facing Kurt Angle next week. Thank God it's not a cage match, so Kurt will live to see another day. He called out Rockstar Spud. He wanted to have a wrestling exhibition with Spud. Spud was wearing amateur wrestling gear with a red bow tie. It's a nice touch. It's completely ridiculous. Kurt Angle finally walked out. He guaranteed he would break EC3's ankle next week. Again, short, to the point, passionate. No herky-jerky, hokey-jokey comedy bullshit. He came out. He was all serious. He said, I'm going to fuck you up next week. And Ethan Carter took a big gulp because he knows next week he's in for the fight of his life. That's the story. I like it. I can buy it. They aired the latest Nux vignette that aired during the pay-per-view last Sunday. He was driving back to TNA with his girlfriend, which sounds like a kidnapping to me. The minute he said we're headed to the impact zone, she should have flung the door open and jumped out. She was cool with things until Nux said that he was picking up somebody named Crazy Steve and the Freak, and then she got very upset. Basically, Nux is coming back so he can make money to send back home to rebuild the arcade or the carnival or whatever the hell it was that got destroyed by the storm. And they're calling their new group The Menagerie. So they debut next week. Let me read you, if I can, the definition of the word menagerie. Okay, I just brought it up in Google. I wanted to see what their definition was. So that's the one that I'm reading to you here. This is their definition. Menagerie. A collection of wild animals kept in captivity for exhibition. A strange or diverse collection of people or things. Is that not the most perfect definition of TNA that you've ever heard? Fuck Nux and his friends. They should just rename TNA The Menagerie. A collection of wild animals kept in captivity for exhibition. That poor roster. That's exactly what TNA is. Bobby Roode beat Gunner to get the title shot against Eric Young. Good match. Clean finish. Gunner went for Hanger 18. Roode raked the eyes to escape. Gunner ended up on the top rope for his diving headbutt, but Roode moved. He nailed the Roode bomb, got the pin. To the back, we see Delusional Dixie flanked by security guards on her way to the ring. Oh, goody. I can't wait. Elsewhere, the Beautiful People, celebrating Angelina Love's title win over Madison Rain last Sunday, got a letter, supposedly from the TNA Board of Directors, saying that they would have to dress in a classy manner from now on or face the consequences. Of all the things for the Board of Directors to be concerned about, they're worried about Velvet Sky showing too much of her ass. Everyone on that board should be expelled because they're not fit to serve. Dixie Carter comes to the ring, and we have the table that Bully Ray spray-painted with her name on it is in there. Delusional Dixie is in there. Talk, 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 talk. I saw her lips moving, but I tuned out. Whatever she said pissed off Bully Ray because he came out, he talked to the security guards, and said, listen, do you really want to do this? Come on now. And they turned to look at Dixie Carter, and they turned back, and they said, eh, you're right, and they walked away. So Bully went into the ring. There were three more security guards in there. He beat them up, and then he teased putting Dixie through the table. He bent her over. Get your mind out of the gutter. But then MVP came out. He told Bully, don't do it. I'm the director of wrestling operations, and I cannot allow that to happen. So Dixie got off the hook. She escaped. Remember that, folks, okay? Abyss can keep a board with nails in it underneath the ring every single week, but this is frowned upon. They were teasing an MVP heel turn here, at least it seemed that way to me, and, well, I don't want to get into the spoilers, but they were teasing an MVP heel turn, and really throughout the entire show they were doing that. He was growing increasingly frustrated with everything going on in TNA. Welcome to my world, MVP. Welcome to my world. He also banned Dixie and Bully from the Impact Zone for the foreseeable future, which makes him a babyface in my book. Willow beat James Storm by DQ after Storm shoved down the referee. Storm then broke a beer bottle across the post and threatened to stab Jeff Hardy to death with the jagged glass. Hey, MVP, where are you at? Apparently this was allowable under his administration. Willow hit him with his $40 umbrella and Storm ran away. Anderson met him on top of the ramp, gave Storm a mic check for costing him the match earlier against Gunner. So that looks like our next feud. The Wolves and Sonata beat the Bromans and DJ Zima in a three-minute match. There was a really wild spot here where the Wolves launched, and I do mean launched, Zima Ion into orbit on a hip toss over the top onto the Bromans outside. That was cool. That was kind of like that Bobby Roode spot a few weeks ago where he caught Kenny King coming off the top in a perfect suplex position. This was also up there. This was wild. Eddie hit Zima with a double foot stomp to the back at the end of the match, followed by a moonsault from Sonata, another foot stomp from Davey to finish them off and get the pin. So next week, it's going to be the Bromans getting their rematch for the tag team titles, which they lost at Sacrifice. I forgot to mention that. The Beautiful People came to the ring wearing evening gowns. They started stripping as their way of sticking it to the board of directors, and just before Velvet was about to take her top off, they stopped and revealed that it was all a swerve, and they were the ones who actually wrote the letter. Wow, you sure got me. Gail Kim came out, said that Angelina was making a mockery of the division that she built. Then she attacked them, but they escaped. Brittany and Madison Rain came up from behind them, stripped them down to their bra and panties, and off ran the Beautiful People. So we have in this segment a swerve, and we have bra and panties. I wonder if Russo just recycles his old scripts from like 15 years ago. You know, just kind of plug the names of the new guys into the script and just hand it in. Wouldn't surprise me. What does surprise me is that the population of this planet, last I checked, was 7 billion people. Planet Earth has a population of 7 billion people, over 300 million of which live here in the United States. 7 billion people. And this fucking company still insists on getting its ideas from this one man. 7 billion people, and that's the best you can do? You've got problems. Main event was Eric Young and Bobby Roode for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. I enjoyed it. Good match. Bobby Roode's always good, but so is Eric Young. Both TNA originals in there doing their thing. Rude kicked out of the pile driver at one point, which is EY's new finisher. EY kicked out of the Rude Bomb. So this was almost built up like a pay-per-view match. You know, they gave them well over 10 minutes. They were kicking out of each other's finishers. You know, at one point, EY went for the Randy Savage elbow, which I guess is his other finisher, off the top rope. And finally, he got the pin. And after the match was over, he extended his hand to Bobby Roode, who was kind of sitting down in the corner. He extended his hand to Roode. And Roode reluctantly accepted. So a gesture of good sportsmanship by the champion. I like that. You know, it was. I figured Roode would make him pay for it, but he never did. So that was kind of different. I liked it. Instead of ending with that, we go backstage to Bully Ray, who is asked, "What are you going to do now that you've been banned?" And Bully says, "It's real simple. I'm going to Nashville, Tennessee." So there you have it, folks. Bully Ray headed to Global Force Wrestling, which is, in fact, based in Nashville. But really, this whole Bully Dixie thing, it's got to end with him putting her through a table at the Manhattan Center tapings that they're doing next month, right? I mean, I can't be the only one thinking that. I wouldn't be surprised if the only reason they even turned Bully Ray babyface in the first place is because they knew they were going to go to New York City. They don't have anybody else who would be over in New York. So I figured that if the only way that this thing could end is with Dixie going through a table. Otherwise, this whole fucking thing is a waste of time. If you're going to do it, I can't think of a better place to have Bully Ray put this woman through a table than in New York City at the Manhattan Center at the Impact tapings. I think the tapings are June 25th, 26th, and 27th. I don't know which one I'm going to yet. Maybe the 27th. But I mean, I guess they have their Slammiversary show, but I would wait if I were them. I would wait until New York, get the big pop, get the big reaction. And that way, once the woman goes through a table, you can keep her off television. That could be her write-off. Put her through a table, and we never have to see her on TV ever again. Yeah, the thing about Vince McMahon, I will say, there were a lot of rumors heading into WrestleMania. The whole storyline was supposed to be that Triple H and Stephanie are corrupt and drunk with power, and Vince wants to wrestle his company back away from them, so Vince would get Steve Austin or The Rock or John Cena or whoever to be his surrogate in a match against Triple H. And I guess plans changed. There was even a Raw show at one point last fall where Vince was advertised, so his return, it was about to happen, and then it just never did. And Vince hasn't really been on television at all. The only time Vince has been on television in recent months was for the Ultimate Warrior tribute. That was it. Even Vince McMahon himself knows when to step away. This woman does not know when to step away. They've got a lot of problems in TNA right now. They got some good stuff, but they got a lot of problems. This woman does not need to be on television. So if the point of this angle is to build to this big moment that gets Bully Ray over as this badass babyface, and Dixie goes bye-bye for a while, fine. But if it's not, then this whole thing is just a waste of time. So that was Impact. And now we move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can send your MP3 audio questions as well. Try to keep them to around 30 seconds or so. And always include the text of your question in the body of the email. Do not just send the attachment. If you do not do that, I will probably not use it. And always include your name and where you are from when you write in. We have this week's audio question from Deathblow David Floyd, who seems to be enjoying his new PayPal nickname. He told me he just got done defending his Chicago heavyweight title in a chutes and ladders match. So this comes from David.
This is Deathblow David Floyd. I have a couple questions for you, brother. Do you see Jim Cornette working with Jeff Jarrett's Global Force Wrestling promotion? I ask this because I know TNA, Jim hated Vince Russo and Dixie Carter, but I didn't really see any bad blood between him and Jarrett. What are your thoughts about that? Second, what are your thoughts about the wrestler Jamie Noble? Was he good, bad? Do you think he was good in Ring of Honor? Stuff like that.
David, please, switch to decaf. Just a little friendly advice. No, I don't see Cornette working in GFW. I don't think there's any major heat between him and Jarrett, other than the fact that Cornette blames Jarrett for hiring Vince Russo in TNA. He said that in interviews before. It was Jarrett's decision to bring in Russo from the very beginning. You know, and Russo and Jarrett were tight from their days in WCW, maybe even as far back as WWE. I don't know how far back the relationship goes, but they were friends. They always liked each other. Russo pushed Jarrett as a champion in both, I guess, but in WCW, towards the end when they were giving guys like Jarrett and Booker a chance to run with the belt when Hogan left. So they had that relationship, and it was Jarrett's suggestion to bring Russo in way back when, and Cornette has always blamed him for that. But I don't think he hates him or anything like that. Russo, yeah. I mean, Cornette hates Russo's guts. He wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire. But Jarrett, I don't think there's any bad blood. I just don't see Cornette doing it. And I don't see why he would do it. You know, he seems to be happy. He lost a whole bunch of weight. He's not under the stress of booking or running a wrestling company anymore like he used to. He's got his own podcast now. I just don't see it. As far as Jamie Noble, boy! I remember that. He was a real good wrestler. I enjoyed the pairing with Nydia in WWE. I still remember the backstage segment on SmackDown when they debuted and Noble attacked Hurricane Helms. You know, he's a talented guy. You know, he must be, since he's working as an agent in WWE now. Dylan from Long Island. I was thinking about how WWE is taking a loss right now on the network with less than 1 million subscribers. There are a lot of people who pay much more than $10 a month, but they want to get as many subscribers as possible. Is there any way to capitalize on those who are willing to pay more while still keeping those who only want to pay $10? My dad is currently using the network for free with my password, and I would bet there are other people doing the same thing. Do you think maybe for $10 they could force a device limit and for a couple of extra dollars allow unlimited devices or something to that effect? I know there will be ads at some point, but what in addition to that can they do to make more while keeping every subscriber? Well, that's the question that every person who runs a network probably asks themselves. Their price is going to go up next year. They're going to have a price increase. I don't know what it's going to be. My guess would be it's going to go up to $12, maybe $15, but maybe that would be too much of a shock to the system, so I could see $12, like $11.99 or something like that. I thought that's what it was going to be from day one, and I would have gladly paid that. And if the price goes up, I will pay the price, because the network is that good. And the fact is, I mean, look, if you want the WWE Network, whether you want the old content, if you want the original stuff like NXT or the reality shows, or if you just want it for the pay-per-views, you're going to pay no matter what. If the difference is $10 a month or $12 a month, or if the difference is $10 a month or $15 a month, $15, okay, maybe some people would start to really squirm, but you're going to pay it. If you really want it, you're going to pay it no matter what, and they know that. So the price is going to go up next year. I can almost guarantee that. As far as charging a higher fee for unlimited devices, that's not going to happen. And I wouldn't do that, even if I were them. I wouldn't do that, because all you're doing there is you're encouraging people to spend a few extra bucks, but then you're telling people, hey, now you can give out your password to as many people as you want to, all your friends, all your family. You know how many subscriptions they're potentially losing by charging, what, an extra $2 a month? I mean, that's just not a good idea. I wouldn't do that. I just think they stay the course, you know, just keep pumping out content. They're adding new content every week, every month. Again, the Clash of the Champions shows now, Saturday night's main event shows. They've got more reality shows in the pipeline. They're going to do more NXT specials. They've got the pay-per-views on there now, which are going to become more important now as Dish Network and DirecTV and other services potentially. I think AT&T, UVerse, whoever uses them, they're not offering them anymore. As that continues and people are stuck without a way to get the pay-per-views, they're going to subscribe to the network. Some may just stop watching altogether, but a lot of those people will have to come over to the network. They'll have no choice if they want to watch these shows every single month. You know, look, if I'm them, I just stay the course. You know, keep pumping out content, bump up the price next year. Will there be some people who say, oh, you know, hell no, I'm not going to pay more money, and they leave? Yeah, I mean, there'll be some. I'm not going to, like, literally there will be none. But it's a tiny, tiny number of people. The people who want the network are going to get the network. Anthony from Philadelphia, my question is in regards to Daniel Benoit's pending pro wrestling debut. I'm conflicted on how I feel about it. On the one hand, I think Daniel is entitled to chase his dream if he truly has a passion for the business, and he should not be discouraged because of who his father was. On the other hand, I feel like the kid, fairly or unfairly, will forever be judged by his father's sins and therefore should find another line of work in which to dedicate himself. Another point to consider is the reality of his chances of success. WWE will never touch him for obvious reasons, and I can't imagine other promotions wanting to deal with the baggage that comes along with being the son of Chris Benoit or having the Benoit name. So that comes from Anthony. I'm with you in that if he really wants to do this, then he should be allowed to do it. He'll find people to train him. I think he's working his first match, and I think he's working with Chavo Guerrero either as a partner. I don't know what the deal is there. But there are people who were friends with Chris Benoit in the business who are kind of guiding Daniel right now and helping him or working with him. And if the kid wants to do it, let him do it. All I can say is this, and Anthony makes a good point when you mention his chances of success. Maybe it turns out to be a situation kind of like Davey Boy Smith Jr., okay, Harry Smith, where maybe he'll find success internationally. If he really dedicates himself to this and he trains and all that and becomes a serious wrestler, he finds success over in Japan or in Europe or something like that. Here in the U.S., there will be indies that will use him. Don't think for a second that because his last name is Benoit, there won't be some indie promoters out there who look at that as a positive and say, oh, we've got the son of Chris Benoit, let's stick his name on a poster and it's controversial and we'll get people to come out. Believe me, there's a lot of promoters who think like that, and they will want to bring him in. Will WWE want to bring him in? I would be stunned. I would be stunned if they did that. And here's something for him to consider, you know, if he's listening. He did a podcast appearance. I don't know if it was a podcast or a Google Hangout, and he had Daniel on as a guest, and I'm watching this, and they're talking about a whole bunch of different things, and obviously what happened with his father, and the current state of wrestling, because, you know, he's a fan, he follows along. He had a lot of unsavory things to say about WWE in this interview. And he took issue with the fact that they basically blackballed his father. It's like his father never exists. They erased him from history. He'll never be in the Hall of Fame. And look, I mean, he's the guy's son, so he's sticking up for his dad. He doesn't think it's right. And, I mean, he was railing. I mean, some of the things he was saying about WWE, it's one of those things where you have to really be careful here. Because if he's serious and he wants to be a pro wrestler, and in his mind, he thinks one day he may have a shot in WWE, you can't go out there and say stuff like that. I mean, you can't go out and do interviews and basically bash the company and then expect that, you know, a few years later they're going to pick you up and send you to developmental and give you a shot. You know, it's not like he's been saying complimentary things about WWE. Either he doesn't care or he just didn't realize it. But I'm watching this interview, and if I'm watching it, other people are, and he's trashing the company that one day he probably is going to want to work for. You know, and that's something that he has to be careful of, and he has to keep that in mind when he goes out and does interviews. If that's how he really feels, that's fine. I get it. But you got to keep that to yourself. If you want to get into wrestling, the only place to really find success on a major league level here in this country is WWE. And if you're going to go out there and you're going to bash WWE for erasing your father from history or whatever else it was that he was bashing them for, don't be surprised if they don't come knocking. Or if you come calling, they don't take the call. I mean, maybe they wouldn't anyway because of the stigma that the name carries with it, but I just, you know, when I heard about him getting into wrestling and all this kind of stuff, I thought back to that interview that I watched. It was the Wrestling Gurus. That's what it was. Just popped into my head. You could probably find it on YouTube. It was actual video, too. It wasn't just audio. It was the Wrestling Gurus. I think that's the name of their channel. If you punch that up in YouTube, you'll probably find the David Benoit interview. I watched that interview. I didn't come away from it with this great view of David Benoit or thinking to myself, wow, this guy really gets it, or he seems to be really passionate to want to be a wrestler, and he's got like a star look to him, or he speaks so eloquently or anything like that. It was a very laid back, yeah, maybe he is that way, maybe it was just that night, he just kind of laid back and whatnot, but you know, I didn't come out of the interview thinking to myself, wow, this guy's going to be a star one day. I came out of the interview thinking, you know, if you want to get into wrestling and get a job with WWE, good luck, because that's not going to happen. Bruno from Miami, whose run with the company did you think was more disappointing, Goldberg in WWE or Bret Hart in WCW? Oh, that's a good one. That is a good one. I want to say that they were equally bad, but if you force me to make a choice, I would say Bret Hart in WCW. I mean, think about their situations, okay? When Bret Hart came over to WCW, there was nobody in wrestling who had more momentum than Bret Hart. He had just been a part of one of the most famous matches in wrestling history, the biggest screw job of all time. He was the WWE champion who never lost the belt. He was the uncrowned or maybe still crowned, whatever you want to refer to it as, WWE champion coming over to WCW. They had their champion, their real champion, coming over to their company. And this was at the peak when wrestling was hot, and it was only going to get hotter. So at the peak of the Monday Night Wars, WCW was kicking ass, they had the bigger audience, they had all the momentum. And Bret came over, and the best thing they could come up with for Bret Hart in his first appearance, his first real appearance at a WCW show, was for him to referee a match. And it wasn't even the main event. He reffed an undercard match. I think it may have been Eric Bischoff's match with Larry Zbysko, I think. That was it. That was their big idea for him on his first night on pay-per-view. And what made it worse was the finish of the Sting-Hogan match, which was completely botched up because Hogan pins Sting fair and square, and then Bret Hart has to come out and sell it like, well, the referee fast counted, you're not going to screw him, I know all about screw jobs, and Bret Hart beats up an innocent referee. Now, after that, you know, he had some feuds. You know, he feuded with Sting, he had a feud with Flair. So he wrestled some of the top guys, and then eventually he won the WCW title. I think it was like a year later. He had a couple of runs with the belt. So it's not like they did nothing with him, but they completely botched the opportunity to do some real big things with Bret Hart right from the very first time he came into that company. And then Bret ended up just another guy in the NWO with Hogan. And then his career there ended. His career in general ended on an injury. Goldberg kicked him in the head. Bret didn't know it. Kept wrestling. It got worse and worse, and he had to retire. So he went out with a whimper. Goldberg, it's kind of similar. You know, he came over from another company, didn't have the kind of momentum that Bret had, because Goldberg had been gone for a couple of years. But he came in, he was over, kind of. Although I remember he got booed in the match with The Rock at Backlash. But they didn't do a good job of booking Goldberg the way that Goldberg should probably be booked. You know, they put the gold dust wig on him, which was just the beginning of the whole thing, and the missed opportunity with him at the SummerSlam Elimination Chamber match when he should have gone over and he didn't. He went over the next month. By then it was almost like it was too late. So like Bret Hart, he came over, he did win the world title. It's not like they didn't do anything with the guy. And then he also went out with a whimper. Even though he won that match at WrestleMania 20 against Brock Lesnar, but that match will go down as one of the biggest letdown. You talk about a big, like, dream-type match. One of the biggest letdowns in history was that Goldberg-Brock Lesnar match where the crowd just completely crapped all over them. And that was it for Goldberg. That was his last appearance in WWE. So like Bret Hart, maybe not to that degree, but like Bret Hart, he also kind of went out with a whimper. So that's why I say they're very similar in that way. Guys who were big stars in their home companies and their home turf who came over and weren't used properly, and went out with a whimper instead of a bang. But I would still lean towards Bret Hart just because, you know, wrestling was so much hotter back then. They had the champion from the other company coming off one of the biggest, I can't even call it an angle. I mean, some people will still believe it's an angle because they're delusional. But coming off that whole Montreal screw job, what they could have done with this guy right out of the gate, and they didn't do it. I have to go with Bret Hart. Between that and his career ending the way it did, you got to go with Bret. Joe in the UK, I watch the JBL and Cole show every single week. I think it's a great show. Obviously, Wade Barrett has benefited from being on there. Cody Rhodes comes across as being a very entertaining character too, but we don't get to see that same character on Raw. My question is, do you think that Cody could ever be a main event player, and do you think Goldust will put Cody over when they do have a match? I would hope so. I don't see what the point of a Cody Goldust feud is, unless Big Brother puts over Younger Brother in the end. I have to assume that's what's going to happen. Cody is a main event superstar. That's an interesting one. They could try, but I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think Cody is going to be the World Heavyweight Champion. I think that at some point maybe they'll try to push him into the main event, but I don't think it's going to last. I don't see them committing to it. I'm not even saying Cody can't do it, but I just don't see it happening. I just don't think, even if they try it, and they may not even try, but even if they try it, I don't see them sticking with it. I don't know that they look at Cody Rhodes as being a main event player. I think they see him maybe as being, you know, like a high mid-card kind of guy. So do I see it happening? No, probably not. Hector from Los Angeles, I was watching the CM Punk documentary and Daniel Bryan states that a lot of guys do this just for the money and hide, so they don't have to wrestle. Who do you think some of these wrestlers are? I don't know who he was referring to, but I mentioned JTG earlier, okay? And I don't want to say, because I don't know JTG personally, I don't know what's going through his head, but JTG is a great example of a guy who's there, who collects a paycheck. I don't know if he's hiding so much as they're hiding him, but he's certainly hidden. Because I don't know where the fuck he is, and nobody else seems to either. And JTG, look, you have to think that it's this point. How much passion could the guy really have? You know what I mean? He doesn't make a stink or a fuss like Zack Ryder does. At least Zack Ryder tries. It's kind of pathetic at this point, but he tries. He started another YouTube show that I think is already dead. He hasn't posted a new episode in like a month. I think somebody went on Twitter and asked him, hey, what happened to your Last Resort show on YouTube? And they said, like, he responded, I don't know. Which can mean anything. I don't know, meaning I don't know if I want to do it anymore, or maybe he said, I don't know, maybe WWE got to him and said, hey, you better stop that shit. I don't know what that means. But the guy tries. If the day comes that Zack Ryder quits or gets cut, at the very least, we can say that guy tried his hardest to get over. He really did. He tried as hard as he could to be successful, and it just didn't work. A guy like a JTG, I don't follow him on Twitter, but you don't really hear from him. You don't see him anywhere. You would have to think at this point that the passion that he may have had has just been beaten out of him, and he's just collecting a paycheck. You know, that's how I read that. So I'd probably lump him in that category. I would think a guy like a Brock Lesnar probably fits in that category. Brock puts everything into what he does. He's the legitimate badass. What they call him when he first came back, the legitimizer in WWE. But, you know, Brock makes no bones about the fact, nor does Paul Heyman when he talks about Brock, that Brock is in it for money. It's a business to him. I don't know that Brock Lesnar really has a passion for pro wrestling. If Brock got an offer to do something similar, something athletic that would pay him as much money or more, and his contract with WWE ran out, he'd probably go do that. So maybe he's another example of a guy who's in it just for the money. Steve from New York City, what do you think the hardest thing is to accept for people who see wrestling for the very first time? Oh, God, I mean, take your pick. Stomping your feet before every punch. Irish whipping somebody into the ropes and they keep running. That's always a fun one to explain. Pretty much any ref bump. Just show them that TNA one from Sacrifice. Greatest thing I've ever seen. Let's see what else. Beating up your boss and not getting fired. That's a good one. Using buzzwords like WWE Universe. Bad dialogue that no human being on the face of the earth would ever use in a normal conversation. Willow. Those are some of the main ones. Michael from Kings Tree, South Carolina. I wanted to relive an unlikely moment in WWE history as Shelton Benjamin was a hot commodity at the time, and I believe it was a Raw roulette show where he ended up wrestling Shawn Michaels. Their match was epic. Do you remember that moment, and do you think WWE should pair up more of these unlikelies in the future? I don't know what you mean by unlikelies, unless you just are referring to the Shawn-Shelton Benjamin match as being kind of like a dream match you never thought would happen. There's not too many of those left, unfortunately, in wrestling, but I don't remember that Shawn Benjamin match being from a Raw roulette show. I think what was happening was Bischoff had made a tournament called the Gold Rush Tournament to crown a new contender for the title, and they happened to face off in the tournament, I think is what happened. That was the first match they ever had. That's a fact that I know for sure. It was the Gold Rush Tournament. That's when Shawn and Shelton had their first match, and it was awesome. It was one of the best matches in Raw history. And they had a second match, I think many months later, on Raw. Unless maybe that match was on a Raw roulette show. Maybe that's what you're thinking of. The rematch was good. It wasn't nearly as good as the original match. It just did not live up to expectations. But that first match was great. And that finish was epic. All-time great finishes in wrestling history was Shelton Benjamin propelling himself off the ropes and Shawn catching him in midair with a super kick right to the face. Just awesome. Awesome stuff. Joseph writes in, Brock Lesnar is one of my all-time favorites. I was only 9 years old when he was on top, so I grew up with him. He's had a hell of a career in WWE, but then he went and conquered UFC. My question is, Ken Shamrock was a former UFC fighter, but I never heard anybody talking about it back then during the Attitude Era. Why is it that with Brock Lesnar being a former UFC champion, it's hailed to make him the baddest dude on the planet, but Shamrock was never looked at in the same light? I wouldn't say that. I mean, they always mentioned ABC calling him the world's most dangerous man. So they did put that out there, like when he first came in. It was a big deal. It was like a big celebrity coming in. You're right in that, you know, Brock has pushed way more as a former UFC champion and being a legit badass. And I don't know why that is. Why they didn't do that with Shamrock. Maybe because Brock was a heavyweight champion there and, you know, Shamrock wasn't. I mean, probably not. Whatever champion Shamrock was, I don't think they had weight classes back then. But, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe they just finally woke up after all these years and they realized, hey, we've got a real fighter here. We could really make him into this unstoppable monster that people would pay money to see. They never did that with Shamrock. You know, after a while, he was just another guy on the roster. He wasn't special anymore. He was another guy in the background in the ring when the corporation would come down. The corporate ministry, I guess, once they merged, you know, and you had Shamrock out there with Bossman and Test and McMahon and I think Triple H in China. They had their little corporate faction, and he was just another guy. He was never a great, like, promo guy. Like, he cut these outstanding promos. But, you know, Brock can't cut a promo to save his life either unless he's in, like, a real setting. And in wrestling, it's very rare that you see a good Brock Lesnar interview. If you're asking him a question in a pre-fight UFC interview, he was great. Or a post-fight interview, he was great. In WWE, probably better to let Heyman do the talking for him, but it certainly hasn't hurt the guy. So I don't know exactly what the deal was with Shamrock. Maybe part of it was just back then during that era, the Attitude Era you mentioned. There were a lot of really good guys back then. Not all of them were UFC guys like Shamrock was, like legit badass guys. But there were a lot of stars, and there were a lot of talented guys back during that Attitude Era. Now, you have a lot of talented guys. Wrestling's not as hot. Maybe they're just looking to build somebody up to, you know, again, try to get people to want to pay to see them. And back then with Shamrock, that just wasn't a priority because they had Stone Cold Steve Austin, they had The Rock, they had The Undertaker, Triple H, DX, all these other acts that were always going to be ranked above Shamrock. That's how much talent they had back then. That's how hot wrestling was. All of those different acts came along at the same time to the point where it pushed Shamrock down as like number 6, 7, 8 in the pecking order there. Maybe in today's WWE in 2014, if Ken Shamrock were 15 years younger and he made his debut, maybe he would be in the position Brock Lesnar is in right now. Or at the very least, he would be in that upper echelon of like top 3 to 5 main event guys on the roster. Because the thing about Shamrock is, and I want to mention this in his defense, I don't think Ken Shamrock gets enough respect from people for being a good wrestler. He wasn't bad at all. I mean, I always thought he was really, really good. He wasn't some guy they just brought in as a celebrity who stunk out the joint because of his name. He had already done some pro wrestling in Japan a long time before he came to WWE. So he had a little bit of experience. He wasn't totally new to it. He was good. You know, I remember him and Rock tearing it up in their King of the Ring finals match back in 98. And that chair shot to the face he took on Raw that one time from The Rock was just, it was brutal. Still the most wicked chair shot I've ever seen. But the short story on Shamrock, underrated guy. Had he come along today, I think he'd be a lot higher up in the pecking order. And I think back then it may have just been a case of wrong time, wrong place. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, 37 years ago, this week on April 30, 1977, superstar Billy Graham beat Bruno Sammartino to win what was then the WWWF title, ending Bruno's final run with the belt. 19 years ago this week on April 29, 1995, the largest crowd ever for pro wrestling assembles at Pyongyang Stadium in North Korea. It's part of the World Peace Festival. 190,000 people. And that shattered the old record that was set one day earlier of 150,000. This was the joint WCW-New Japan collision in Korea, which was a two-day event that attracted 340,000 fans total. It's easy to attract that many people in North Korea because when you're told to be somewhere, you better be there, or else bad things are going to happen. Show featured WCW guys like Road Warrior Hawk, Steiner Brothers, and Ric Flair, who lost to Antonio Inoki in the main event, their one and only match against each other. Chris Benoit wrestled as Wild Pegasus. Scott Norton was there, too. Flair tells the story of how Norton was on the phone to his family at one point, and he was telling them that he wasn't very happy about being there. He wanted to go home. And all of a sudden, his phone cut off. You know, I'm sure those guys were being watched by the government every single minute they were there. But that's pretty spooky stuff. And if you're in that situation, you've got to be at least a little nervous. Yeah, I know these are big, tough guys, but you're out of your element. You're in this foreign country. You're being watched, and you feel like you're being watched all the time. And you are. I mean, when you go around, and again, Flair talked about this too, you almost have what they call a minder. You always have at least one person kind of attached to you as your guy whose purpose is really just to keep an eye on you. They watch what you're doing. They watch what you're saying. And it's got to, you know, freak you out a little bit. You know, I'm sure they all felt that way. Flair said it was very intimidating. The moment they landed, they split everybody up. They took all their passports away from them. They took them to different hotels. And again, they assigned them a person to watch over them the entire time that they were there. Then when the event was over, they couldn't even go straight home. They kept them there for a few more days. They wanted them to make a public statement after their time there, saying how now that we've been here, we see how North Korea could dominate the United States if they wanted to. You know, Flair just said he was thrilled and honored to be there. He couldn't bring himself to say that. I can believe all of it. I can believe everything he said about that experience. I just watched a documentary. It was on HBO called The Hermit Kingdom. It was short, maybe like half an hour. They traveled to North Korea with Dennis Rodman and some of the Harlem Globetrotters to play a basketball game against a team of North Korean players. And they got a whole tour of the country. They even got to visit Kim Jong-un, okay, the president over there of North Korea, or the supreme leader, whatever they call him. And you watch this, and it's just incredible. It's incredible to think that something like this is actually happening in another part of the world. You know, the government so clearly staged all of these different meetings that they had with these different people. I remember there's one scene where they take the Americans to visit, like, it's a computer lab or a library somewhere, and it's all quiet, as most libraries are. But there's this one guy who's sitting there. Supposedly, he's on the computer working, okay? But they show him, the camera's shooting him. He's just staring at the Google homepage. He's just staring at it. He's not doing anything. He's moving his mouse around, but he's not actually clicking anything or doing anything. It's hilarious. Everyone they meet, they just seem so nervous. And you know, why wouldn't they be? They know they're being watched. I'd be nervous too. It's actually a really fascinating documentary. It's on YouTube. If you just type in The Hermit Kingdom, it should come right up. It's worth going out of your way to watch. 18 years ago this week on April 28th, 1996, Good Friends, Better Enemies, In Your House pay-per-view featured the final appearances for Big Daddy Cool Diesel and Razor Ramon. I'm not counting the fake Diesel and Razor or Diesel's comeback at the Rumble a few years ago. Both guys were headed to WCW. Razor got squashed by Vader. And by squashed, I mean literally squashed. Vader sat down on his chest and pinned him. Diesel put over his best buddy, Shawn Michaels, in the main event. Shawn's first title defense since beating Bret Hart at WrestleMania. Yeah, this may be the best Kevin Nash match he ever had. He had some good matches with Bret Hart. You know, it wasn't like every single Kevin Nash match was atrocious. He had some good ones. This was probably the best one, though. They went in there. They had a no-holds-barred brawl. So they beat the crap out of each other. They did a spot where Diesel powerbombed Shawn through the announce desk on the outside. The first time that had ever happened in WWE. So long before the Shield started powerbombing people through the announce table. Diesel did that to Shawn, and this was one of those old crappy, you know, wooden announce tables that just kind of breaks in half. Monitors went flying. Yeah, he didn't clear the desk of the monitors and all that kind of stuff, so they go flying in the air, and Shawn's laying in this just heap of rubble, and Vince McMahon is trying to, you know, he's moving the monitors off Shawn, trying to, like, unbury him here. And in the end, they did this very, I guess, controversial to some. I liked it. It was completely tasteless, but it fit the narrative that Diesel was an asshole who was willing to do anything to win. He went outside the ring, and Mad Dog Vachon was sitting at ringside. Now, Mad Dog Vachon, very famous wrestler, just passed away recently, had his leg amputated. He lost his leg in an accident where he was jogging on the side of the road and a car ran him over. This was back in the late 80s. So he had a prosthetic leg. Nobody knew this. None of the fans watching knew this. So Diesel just casually walks over. He moves aside the part of the guardrail and just unprovoked grabs Mad Dog. People start freaking out. He very gently puts him down on the ground and he starts yanking at his leg. And I can't figure out what he's trying to do. He rips his leg out. Now imagine if you're a younger fan or you're a fan who has no idea who this guy is, or you know it's Mad Dog, but you don't know he's got a fake leg. Imagine the reaction to something like that for the first time. Because they've done this angle since. They did it with Roddy Piper and Zach Gowen, I think, many years ago on SmackDown. But this was the first time, at least in WWE, that something like this was done. And the people were appalled. They couldn't believe it. It was this shocking moment. And Diesel's holding the leg up like a trophy, and he brings it into the ring, and he's going to hit Sean with it. But then Sean gives him a low blow. Sean takes the leg. He's making like he's Babe Ruth calling his shot. Hits Diesel in the head with it, super kick, 1-2-3. Great finish, great angle to a really, really good match that highlighted this show. Also on the show, the Ultimate Warrior beat Goldust in a terrible match. So the polar opposite of the main event. I don't even know if you could call it a match, really. Goldust was defending his Intercontinental title here. He came into the match with a injured knee. So he really couldn't do much. So we had a lot of stalling, a lot of smoke and mirrors. Finally, Warrior clotheslined Goldust out of Marlena's director's chair that he was sitting in the ring. And Goldust just left and got himself counted out. That's literally all there was to it. And for those of you who have the network, if you want to see one of the segments that led to this match between Warrior and Goldust, it's up on the network right now. It's in the Raw replay section under 1996. It's from like April of 96. It was the show where the Ultimate Warrior came back. Vince McMahon interviewed him. One of the best Ultimate Warrior promo segments I've ever seen. He's very coherent in the segment. And it's an interesting look into what I think a modern day version of the Ultimate Warrior character, maybe during like the Attitude Era, not so much today, would have been had he stuck around for more than 4 months. You know, his runs never really did last very long. Except the original one. But, you know, he's actually very coherent. Goldust comes in, he's pretending, you know, because Ultimate Warrior, I don't know if he was homophobic in real life or not. Clearly he's made comments that to that effect. Was it just for show? Does he really feel that way? Who the hell knows? But in this segment, they were playing off the homophobic vibe of the Goldust character back then. Goldust was touching him. Warrior's like, don't touch me, and stuff like that. But Warrior just starts, he's like dropping cuss words in this segment, stuff you would never see the Ultimate Warrior do back in the 80s and the early 90s during that, you know, kids run in WWE. He's here talking about, you know, I don't go for that shit, and they bleeped shit. And then one of the best Warrior lines in any promo ever. You know, Goldust was a big movie buff back then. Warrior's tired of his nonsense, and he just goes, you know, if you're looking for a full-length, action-packed adventure, I got a full-length movie for you. Me kicking your ass from beginning to end. And then he just clotheslined the crap out of Goldust. And the segment ended. It was great. And you can watch that if you have the network, because it's up in the, again, in the 1996 section right now. Much better than the match itself. 14 years ago this week, April 30th, 2000, WWE's Backlash pay-per-view saw Dean Malenko beat Scotty Too Hotty to retain his light heavyweight title in a hell of a match with a great finish, reversing an attempted superplex into an avalanche DDT. It's a great spot. That was off the top rope, mind you. It's awesome. Big Show came out for a match with Kurt Angle, dressed up as the Showster, dressed up as Hulk Hogan. Main event was Rock beating Triple H to win the WWE Championship. Shane McMahon was the guest referee. He got taken out midway through the match, a double rock bottom spot through the announce table. Vince McMahon did everything he could to screw Rock out of this match until finally Stone Cold showed up. He was supposed to be in the Rock's corner. He never did show up until later in the match. He came out. He obliterated everybody with a steel chair. Triple H, Pat Patterson, Gerald Briscoe, Shane, Vince. Chair shots to the head for everybody. Austin was only 3 months removed from spinal fusion surgery. Really, he had no business being out there, which would explain why he didn't really do anything beyond hitting people with a chair. You know, there was no stunners or anything like that. But from the moment that glass shattered to the moment the referee counted three for The Rock, the crowd would not stop making noise. It was the longest sustained reaction I've ever heard. You know, I know Hogan got that great ovation in Canada when he came back in 02 on SmackDown, I think it was. But this, I mean, this went from music hits, here comes Austin, chair shot to this guy, chair shot to that guy, Austin leaves, you know, oh look, there's Linda McMahon and Earl Hebner, the fired referee. Linda shoves Stephanie down to the ground, spine buster, people's elbow, place is going ape shit. Hebner climbs in, counts to three, place explodes, people losing their minds. Just pandemonium from start to finish. It was great. I still say this should have happened at WrestleMania, though, but I'm going to just assume that Austin was still too injured. They wanted to wait for Stone Cold to be able to do a run-in, so maybe they saved it for Backlash, but that's the way WrestleMania should have gone off the air that year. 11 years ago this week, on May 1st, 2003, Miss Elizabeth passed away. Her real name was Elizabeth Hewlett, 42 years old. The cause of death was acute toxicity from mixing vodka and pain pills that she had been taking for a bad back. They ruled it an accidental overdose. She started choking, I guess, while she was eating. Lex Luger, who was her live-in boyfriend at the time, called 911 because he noticed she wasn't breathing. She was turning purple. And so he called 911. Cops ended up arresting Luger on felony drug possession charges. They searched his house. They found over 1,000 illegal pills, anabolic steroids, testosterone, bunch of other drugs. Luger pleaded guilty to possession. First-time offender, so he only got probation and had to submit to drug tests to prove that he was no longer taking steroids. He and Elizabeth had been together going back to the dying days of WCW. There was a domestic dispute between the two less than a month before her death, where Luger allegedly hit her, gave her two bruised eyes and a cut lip, so a real winner, this guy. You know, her death was really sad. I mean, I, like a lot of you guys, grew up on Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth when I was a kid. And I don't know that Macho Man would have been as successful as he was without her. You know, he would have been okay, but she put that whole act over the top. You know, she really did. She was as important a part of that act as anything else. And she didn't do much, but she didn't have to do much. She would come out there. She knew how to play her character perfectly. She was this, you know, perfect picture of class. She would come out wearing these great classy outfits, and she would be, she was kind of timid, and she would stand by her man, and she would wave to the fans, and she, she was perfect. She was just perfect in that role, and I think it was a big part of why Macho Man ended up getting over as a babyface. It had a lot to do with people loving Liz. Even when Macho was a heel, people didn't hate Elizabeth. She didn't do anything evil or nefarious or interfere and low blow people or trip them or any of that kind of BS. She was who she was. She would, Macho kind of abused her. I say abused, but, you know, he would talk down to her and stuff like that. That was all part of his character. And you felt bad for her. You felt sympathy for her. It was impossible to hate her even when Macho Man was a heel. And, there were stories that Elizabeth was actually called what they call a ring rat back in the day, which is basically a woman who hangs around the wrestlers looking to have sex with them. I don't know how accurate that is. There's been stories like that for a long time, that's kind of how she ended up with Randy. You know, and also that she used to be a lot heavier than we all remember her being. She lost a bunch of weight, and that's why she looked the way that she did. But apparently before that, she had been, how heavier, I don't know. I've never seen a picture, so I have no way of knowing. But she got involved with Randy Savage, working for his dad's promotion at the time, ICW, and they got married in 84. Breaking kayfabe here, they didn't actually get married at SummerSlam in 91. They were married a long time before that. She did commentary for ICW for a while, and then came over when Randy came to WWE in 85. And they did that great angle where all the managers were vying for the services of Randy Savage. There's no better way to try to get somebody over as being a big deal than having all the managers go crazy and saying, I want this guy. And they're all kind of hustling each other and bidding against each other. And it made Savage's debut into a really big deal. And then finally, when it comes time for D-Day, you know, who do you pick as his manager? As it turned out, it was none of the usual suspects. It wasn't Slick. It wasn't Fred Blassie. It wasn't Bobby Heenan, Jimmy Hart. He introduced Elizabeth. That was her debut, and she was stunning when she walked out there. There were also stories that it was her idea. The whole genesis of the Mega Powers angle, which to me is one of the best in the history of that company, was supposedly an idea that originated with Elizabeth. I don't know how involved in that whole process she was. Storyline-wise, she was a big part of it. She was the reason they broke up. But that whole Mega Powers angle, from the moment it started, when they became allies, to the moment they broke up on that main event show, when Savage, you know, bailed on Hogan during the tag match and attacked him backstage, that angle was so great. It was just such great stuff. And Elizabeth was a huge part of that. And apparently behind the scenes, she may have been a big part of that as well. They did the reunion of WrestleMania 7 when Savage and Liz reunited. And, you know, I'm not afraid to admit that, you know, I go back and watch that angle and those damn ninja chopping onions get to me sometimes. You know, I'm man enough to admit it. That was awesome stuff. And we had some people actually recently on our Facebook group posting pictures of some of the fans that they showed in the audience from WrestleMania 7 when they reunited. Very emotional. You'd expect a lot of women to get all teary-eyed and stuff like that, and they did. And Bobby Heenan was awesome on commentary. They would show these women crying in the crowd. It was supposed to be a feel-good moment. And they show them, and Heenan's on commentary just going, oh, maybe her shoes are too tight, you know? Shouldn't have had the chili dog with onions. And then they showed this one kid, a guy. I don't know what the fuck this guy was wearing. I guess maybe like his own homemade Macho Man hat, which is probably why he looks so ridiculous. The actual Macho Man hat looked ridiculous. Imagine a homemade version. But he's like crying and smiling, and it was just the most hilarious thing. So they did that whole thing, the wedding at SummerSlam 91, the whole thing with Flair heading into WrestleMania in 92, she was mine before she was yours. Even when the match was over, you know, and Savage won the belt, and Flair grabbed Elizabeth, and he's like, you know, what about me? And he kisses her. He forces himself on her. And Liz just starts, like, wildly slapping the crap out of Flair. Very rare that you saw Elizabeth get physical in WWE. It did happen sometimes, the stuff with Sherry and all that, but that was a great angle as well that year. And as was the case with a lot of people who went from WWE to WCW, they never really did anything with her. Nothing memorable anyway. She was back with Randy for a bit. I think she may have turned on him again. She joined the NWO. She never felt special. And that was the case with a lot of people when they went, especially the not necessarily even the main event people, but maybe mid-card type people. When they came over to WCW, they took the big fat paycheck to come over because they had a name at one point, so they gave them a contract. They never meant a damn thing. It was never, ever a situation where they could recapture that magic. It just never happened, and you know, it was the same thing with her. But she will go down, I think, as one of the more influential figures and influential managers. You think of her a little bit differently. She wasn't out there taking bumps. She wasn't out there cheating and that kind of stuff, but she played her role perfectly, and she served a very important role, I think, in the career of Randy Savage. And I don't think that should be forgotten. And all this talk about how Macho Man deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and every single year there's this big movement to get Macho Man inducted, and will he ever be inducted? I hope and think he will be at some point, but we've got to keep Elizabeth in that conversation as well. And I would even advocate that when that day comes that Macho Man is inducted into the Hall of Fame, that same year, that same class, maybe even as a package deal, it should be the Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth together going into the Hall of Fame. 9 years ago this week, on April 28, 2005, Chris Candido, who worked for, I think, pretty much every major promotion there was back then, including WWE, WCW, ECW, Smoky Mountain, TNA, he passed away, 33 years old. And you know, what makes the Candido thing even sadder is that he had seemingly gotten his life back together after many years of substance abuse. It's a lot like Eddie Guerrero in a lot of ways. Eddie had his demons. Eddie had his battles with drugs and alcohol and that sort of stuff, and had seemingly, at least in terms of the alcohol, had seemingly gotten his life back in order, but the damage was kind of already done at that point. That's where the story becomes a little bit different. I'm comparing the two just because here's another example of a guy who had licked his demons and met an unfortunate fate at, you know, just a horrible time. What happened with Candido, though, is a little bit different. He was having success in TNA. This is the early days of TNA. He was managing the Naturals, which was the team of Chase Stevens and Andy Douglas. They were one. It was the Naturals and America's Most Wanted. They were some of the bigger teams back then in the early days of I guess it was NWA TNA at the time. And he had just managed them to a tag team title win at the Impact tapings, and they actually beat AMW on that show. Now, right before that, what happened here is Candido also wrestled for TNA. He was part of a tag match. It was him and Lance Hoyt against Apollo and Sonny Siaki at the Lockdown pay-per-view. And early in that match, Candido broke his leg. It was a freak thing. I think it was when he was in the ring with Siaki. And Siaki may have taken him over, I think, for a hip toss. And I think he like rolled his ankle a certain way. But whatever happened, he broke it. Broke his leg. I think his ankle. He had surgery the next day. They put in a bunch of plates and screws. He was the bionic man. That was on a Monday night. The very next day, he appeared at the tapings managing the Naturals. So he dove headfirst right back into things. I mean, he could not wait to get back there. He did not take much time off, clearly. He was right back into things. I think I remember reading at the time he refused to stay in the hospital overnight because he was afraid of the painkillers, given his past issues with addiction. He just didn't want to be around that kind of stuff. He didn't trust himself. Willpower thing, I guess. So, you know, a day or two later, after the tapings, he boarded a flight home, which was not the wisest move, because you're not supposed to get on an airplane so soon after the kind of surgery that he had. You know, you're sitting there for a long period of time. You have to have your legs raised and stuff, and I'm going to assume that wasn't the case with him. And the reason being, it can cause blood clots. And those blood clots, or deep vein thrombosis, it's called, and those clots can travel to all different parts of your body. You know, they could travel to your heart, your lungs, your brain, I think. Well, sure enough, after he got home, he got very sick, and he died soon after from a blood clot. So the guy gets his life together. He breaks his leg in a freak accident in a match in TNA, and he ends up dying because of it. So that's what makes the Chris Candido story so sad. He was a really talented guy who had some troubles, as a lot of wrestlers did from back then, especially guys from that ECW era, in terms of the drugs and all that kind of stuff. A lot of them had problems. Seemingly licked them, but in the end, it was something, just a complete freak thing that took his life. Just a very, very sad situation. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I also wanted to mention something really quick here about Bobby Heenan. There was a note in the Observer newsletter this week, a health update on Bobby Heenan, that he had just broken his shoulder from a fall out of bed. I guess he fell out of his bed, broke his shoulder. And, you know, it's not the first time that something like that has happened. I've heard a lot of stories about Heenan breaking, whether it's his arm, his back, just by falling or rolling out of bed. And the reason for that is, you know, his history is well documented as far as Heenan beating throat cancer. He's beaten throat cancer back twice now, but it's taken its toll on him, because especially when you're focusing all the chemotherapy and radiation up there towards your jaw, your mouth, your throat, they use so much of it to try to beat it and save his life that it destroyed his jaw. They had to rebuild his jaw because it basically kind of crumbled. I mean, that's why he looks the way he does now. Long story short. But the other unfortunate side effect of all that chemotherapy and all that radiation, which is, I mean, that stuff, it's almost as bad as the disease itself. The bad thing about that is it made his bones very brittle. So somebody like you or me, you know, if I fall out of bed, which I did plenty of times as a kid, okay, can't you tell? It really wouldn't mean anything. I mean, look, you could hurt yourself, I suppose. You could break your arm or your shoulder or something, but chances are it's not going to happen. With him, he's in such a fragile state, and his bones are so brittle that even the slightest fall or something like that happening, he can break something. And so that's unfortunately why he's broken things, and I guess he broke his shoulder. So I hope he's doing well. It's great to hear that he's still, you know, kicking and living life and living life with his grandkids and all that kind of stuff. His story is another sad one. You know, when you take somebody like Bobby Heenan, who made a living and made his reputation off his mouth, right? That's what he did his whole career. He ran his mouth, man. He was a great manager. He was a great promo guy, a great announcer. And Lee Marshall just passed away, the former WCW announcer, the voice of Tony the Tiger. He also apparently died from cancer of the esophagus. Yet another guy who had a great voice. Lee Marshall had a great voice, and I had no idea he was also battling throat cancer. It's just this cruel twist of fate, you know, when you find out that somebody who makes a living, essentially using their mouth, is now suffering some condition that is robbing them of their voice. So hopefully Bobby Heenan's doing well. He's the best ever at doing what he did. So best wishes to him. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster is my handle on there. You can also friend me on Facebook. We're all over there. We're on YouTube as well. We have a YouTube channel with some exclusive Sound Off extra content that you can find posted up there. Please subscribe to the show, both on Stitcher and in iTunes. And you can also leave us a review. I haven't promoted that in a while, but it always helps when you leave a written review for the show, what you think about it. You can do that in iTunes, and you can also do that in Stitcher as well. And please consider leaving a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. A lot of you have been doing that. I very much appreciate that. Give whatever you want. Give whatever you can. Every little bit helps to support the show. Also, please consider signing up for an Audible trial. It's another way to help the show. Kick a little back towards us. You get a free 30-day trial. It's an audiobook service. You don't have to commit to it beyond 30 days if you don't want to. If you're not happy with it or it's not your thing, you can cancel at any time during those 30 days. You do not get charged, but you do get to keep your one free audiobook. So I don't know why you wouldn't even sign up for it. It makes no sense why you wouldn't try it. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster is the URL for that. For the people who have been asking me, what are the different ways I can support the show? I don't have an Amazon banner, or at least not yet, or anything like that. PayPal and Audible right now are probably the two big ways that you can support the show. So thank you very much for doing that. We will call it quits here. This has been a nearly 2.5 hour show that I've done here, so I hope you can appreciate the length here. I did not expect to go this long. But we had a big show this week, and we'll be back with episode 327 next week. We'll talk about Extreme Rules. We'll talk about Raw, Impact, everything else that's happening. Any week now, we should also find out more about the WWE television rights deal. They said nothing about it on their investors call on Thursday. I guess things have been delayed a little bit. I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign. We could find out any week now, and you know, when we do, that's going to really tell the tale for WWE for the rest of this year going forward. That as much as anything, is going to be probably one of the biggest stories of the year to look to. That and also how the TNA television situation shakes out there. So we'll bring you all that next week and a whole lot more. Until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you for supporting the show. Enjoy Extreme Rules if you are checking out the show tonight. And we will see you right back here again next week. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
I beat the authority, and right now I stand here as the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion.
The bad.
Brock Lesnar into the cover. Hooks the leg. The streak is over.
And the ugly.
Well, we are here with the new married couple.
Now we're tag team partners for life.
Sean and Marty said the same thing once upon a time.
Oh, I knew he was going to do that.
What a despicable act that was.
Oh, my God.
Well, mostly the good.
Solomon Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solomonster Sound Off.